Chairperson. Let me start by saying thank you to yourself and to the committee for once more giving us this opportunity to come and talk to you and share with you our activities over the past year. We always look forward to coming here because we always walk out or go back with a sense of where we should be going, what we should be doing better, and issues of concern to this committee. So we always look forward to coming here. I'll start by introducing the team that approached today. Sitting next to me is Ms. Edith Vidalanka. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the Legal Aid Board. Behind me, I've got a new addition to the operational team, Mr. Thierry Mapokwane. He is the Chief of Operations of the Legal Aid Board. Next to him, we've got Ms. Rebecca Sabatau. You know her. She's the Chief Finance Officer of the organization. Then we've got Mr. Brian Nair. He is the National Operations Executive. Then I brought some board members just to hold my hand as I do this. And sitting next to Brian and I is Mr. Jan Maria, the board member of Long Standing, the Legal Aid Board. Then we've got Professor Yusuf Bauda, he's a new board member. This is his second year for that meeting. We've got Velna Lemley, she's the regional operations executive of what we call Kopano. That encompasses Gauteng, Limpopo, and part of Northwest. And right at the back, they would like to look at themselves as a backbencher, so only that applies to
yes.
But we've got Ms. Cordelia Robertson, she's the regional operations executive of the Western Cape and Northern Cape. Yeah, Ms. Robertson has also taken a bit of the Northwest province under the wing. And then we've got Ms. Tembi Lemtati. He is the regional executive for the Eastern Cape and Free State. And then next to Tembi Lemtati, the lady, I don't know, she's not in my team. But next to her is Robert F. Raven. He's the Justice Center Executive of the Cape Town Justice Center for the Legal Aid Board. And then we've got Mark Gartley. He's the Justice Center Executive of the Aslo Justice Center. I'm expecting another board member, Mr. Diane Safari. He is the new board member.
Thank you, Jess. Please, you can proceed when you're ready with the presentation. Let's take this document.
Thank you, Chair. I think my part of the presentation today is just to comment on some aspects of our strategic initiative for the next 3 years, starting last year. We've sent the committee the documents. I will not be speaking beyond the version. You will have noticed that in the set of documents you received, you have received this document, which is the whole strategic document that we've crafted. I will not be speaking to it because there's a lot of detail.
That's the question,
but I'll
try to give. I just made a mistake for you, and if at the back parliament generally, not just these meetings. Because, you know, we all operate in our constituency, and it is very, very useful for individual members of parliament to have that particular matter in their constituency of. I unfortunately don't have the capacity to go close to that while I get time. You wouldn't believe it, but I don't. But it'd be very useful if you can make that available to us. We will then undertake to distribute it to each member of parliament. Which would be very useful.
Thank you, Chair. So that can be done. My CEO point to me outright. I know the product was sent to you has a map outside. Yeah, she says that's the most
effective.
Yeah. And the contact details of all the people who mend those offices are from those places. So those places going there.
Were you thinking something that is worth? Yeah, we want to distribute to all 400 members. We don't have sufficient number.
We will do that, Chair, in the same...
Don't send me the annual report.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we'll send you
the office is not big enough. sorry about that. Please proceed. I won't interrupt you.
No, thank you, Chair. We'll make the copy in the safe understanding that the committee is acutely aware of some budgetary reality. Chair, as I said, I'm not going to be talking too much, just to make a few comments on some of the issues we look at when we discuss our strategic plan. I think we found it important that we should just look at our vision, mission, as well as our values to sort of guide the whole process in crafting our strategic plan. And then the next important thing that we looked at was our mandate. We had to revisit as to where does our mandate come from. In the first instance, our mandate, we think, comes from the Constitution, particularly from Section 35, Section 35.2, as well as Section 35.3. And in respect of children in particular, there's a direct provision in terms of Section 28.1 about the provision of legal aid. So we view that those sections to be key to our mandate of providing legal services to South Africa. And then our mandate also emanates from the Legal Aid Act, which creates us in terms of which we do our things. There are a number of other legislative pieces which have an injunction on us to provide legal aid. I've not set them out in the document, but they've been set out in the other documents that we've annexed to you regarding legal aid in South Africa in the next 20 years. Now, in looking at our strategic initiative, we had to decide what direction we take and how transformative input we put on the judgment, and we looked at the historical perspective of where we've come from as an organization and in this country. You see those aspects that we looked at. We call it the Legal Aid for Transformation Continuum, which sort of maps out the path the Legal Aid Board has gone through from its dysfunctional days. We say dysfunctional advisory, we think that's what it was, but with the support of this committee in particular, we've been able to come to where we are. So we dealt with that. And then we then had to look at the context within which we operate as a legal aid board. You'll notice that I'm jumping quite a number of slides because I don't want to bore you with details. I'm just dealing with those aspects of being very important. In terms of the context, we looked at a number of factors and we divided them up into categories. The first group of factors that we looked at were the external factors which have an impact on the legal aid board as such. And we first looked at the justice sector. And I'm going to spend some time on this one because I think we found it very important. The first one is, we noticed that there was a growing number of police and the employment of police, as well as the refocusing of policing strategies. These, in our view, were resulting and would result in an increased number of crimes, and that has an effect on us because there will be an increased need for our services, those people are arrested. We also took note of the fact that though there's a downward sort of trend in crime as such, but the workload resulting from serious crime has increased by about 20% over the past 10 years. We also looked at the number of cases that the National Prosecution Authorities have got to the court between 1999 and 2003. We also are acutely aware, and it's an issue that has been debated in this committee with us, the overcrowding in prison and what can be done to alleviate that situation. We have, I think, with this committee and other role players, identified 7 prisons where there's an 80% or so awaiting trial perspective, and that requires attention. It has to be attended to. And then we have also looked at the impact of certain legislation on the justice system, in particular the minimum sentencing legislation. There's been a lot that has been said about this legislation, but as a legal aid board, we have seen its effects, and some of them are not very palatable, particularly to our PAs, in terms of the straitjacketing of, or rather the putting into compartments of certain sentences, irrespective of what the circumstances may be relating to the different cases. So we looked at that, and then continuing with the justice sector, we looked at the establishment of new courts by the Department of Justice. We said this in past presentations to this committee, that it has an impact on us because it creates an expectation on us to service those costs, and there is no concomitant increase of our budget to make sure that we cover those costs, either with our own staff or through judicators. We have also listed in our documents the unequal resourcing between the agencies in the justice cluster. I've spoken about this last year, that we are sometimes criticized that our lawyers are not prepared properly or don't consult sufficiently. And we mentioned why that is so. Where our PAs run court, and magistrates love this, they prefer our PAs because they know they can rely on them being in court. If magistrates in the regional court of storage don't know that this court is meant by this particular PA from the legal report, that magistrate expects that PA to be that court 5 days a week. Now, we've mentioned this in the past, but it gives that PA very little time to prepare if he's in court every day. So we've asked that if our funding could be increased so that we go to at least 1.5 PA per court, because it would release some capacity for our PAs to attend to other case management aspects of their work. We mentioned in the document that in our experience, the National Prosecuting Authority employs 2 PAs per court, and we think that it's a bit skewed. We then looked at, regarding our strategic initiative, we looked at a number of justice and legal sector initiatives which were meant to correct what was happening in the criminal justice system. I'm sorry, I've sort of lost track because I'm looking at the different document here. But anyway, we looked at the case backlog testing where we are involved. We also looked at the criminal justice review, as well as the legal services charter initiative. We are party to all those initiatives. We think we have to be party to them because we are a key player in the justice system of this country. So in our strategic initiative, we had to look at what could we do in terms of crafting strategies to place us adequately in a position to respond to what we have to do in that context. We also looked at the capacity of the Department of Justice to process our documents. I mentioned this in another slide, but the legal aid guide, which has to be ratified by Parliament every year, was last ratified by this Parliament in 2002. It is a matter of concern to us. We mentioned this, but we can't continue operating on secular. Parliament has to tell us that we're on the right track. There are a number of other things that are engaged there. The Legal Aid Act, which is being, we hope, being rewritten. We've made submissions on this. I think we've had dealings with the Deputy Minister on this aspect, and he told us how we would like to see the process unfolding. We also submitted two documents to the Ministry. In the first one relates to legal aid in South Africa in the next 2 decades, as well as a document on civil legal aid. These two documents arise from discussions I had with the Minister. I think I came out of this committee 2 years ago after we debated the issue of civil legal aid, and we had left with an understanding that we were going to form a meeting of sorts to call key role players to debate this issue. The minister then had a meeting with me and told me that she should prefer to approach it differently, and she asked for these documents to be provided to her. They were provided to her. We've asked for meetings as a follow-up to see where we can go in that regard. We feel asking, but we hope this committee will also come into the frame that we take the process where we can discuss. I think we have put them in the text. You've got them in the next. As well as the one on civil legal aid, also there. Both of them are there. We thought that is why. Yes. We annexed them to this presentation because we think we've done what we had to do in terms of researching the issue concerning civil legal aid and what has to happen. And we think the stage is set now for a proper discussion and an understanding to be heard by everyone involved as to what should be happening, whether the concept of civil legal aid exists or not. We all just think it exists.
We obviously have views on that, but I think it's quite right.
Yes. Thank you very much. I then go to the other sectors that we looked at. That's the next slide. The legal sector sectors. We mentioned one aspect, and I think I want to just talk about it a little bit, that there's a limited national pool of experienced legal professionals being taken up by the corporate and large private sector firms. This results in staff retention difficulties and challenges of attracting and retaining professionals, particularly in the rural areas. There's always a criticism by some magistrates that we field recently qualified and somewhat inexperienced people in their court. Our hands are tied. We attract them as candidate attorneys, and we train them very well, we think. But as soon as they've acquired enough experience, they leave. One big reason we've identified is because within ourselves in the justice cluster is that the conditions of service, particularly salary, are not aligned. we're still in the lowest end. Currently, we have a serious problem on our hands because the Department of Justice has sort of upgraded the salaries of its lawyers. And we know that the NPA has also done the same thing. We were promised some money. That was given some money to also do the same for us. We were asked for statistics and details to provide those. It's not happening. Unfortunately, our lawyers are aware of these initiatives and there are rumblings on the ground. I'm just mentioning this just to for this committee not to be surprised if you read that there may be some industrial action about this. We'll try to explain it as best as we can, but you see, it's a problem. We are discussing with the DOJ, with the DG. He's very cooperative, I must say. But we still have to see where this ends, but it is a problem to us. It has an impact because it creates instability in our ranks. People leave, and then we've got to train new people, we've got to find new people to take over where they left. So you see that there's always a high staff turnover in our ranks, and we think it comes from that. And then another aspect I need to talk about is in the next slide. This relates to our relationship with the professional legal bodies. We think the tension between us, in fact, we don't think there is a tension between us and some law societies. This dates back to when the Justice Center model was established. There's been a view, and it's a view that continues to exist, that the Justice Center model has taken work away from lawyers. We continue to engage them to give them an understanding of why it has to be that way. We also know that the majority of judges and magistrates would prefer our Justice Center PAs to obtain their costs than judicial lawyers. We've mentioned some of the problems we have with judicial lawyers, particularly the quality assurance measures that we have with our own people. We're still looking at ways as to how we can do that with judicial practitioners. But there's a tension. The Northern Provinces Law Society wants to accredit our justice centers as if it's a law clinic. We've told them that they can't do that. But they have their own reasons why they want to do that. We've threatened court action to get a declaration that they can't do it. But without mentioning it, because if you have seen in their own documents, and I think there's one document from the LSSA, if I'm not mistaken, where the view continues to be propounded that the Legal Aid Board is encroaching on their areas in terms of taking work away from them. They've been writing negative things about the Legal Aid Board. They now want us to stop, to give an example, our self-branding initiative, because they say that amounts to advertising and that way we take work away from them. We know that we have a mandate and we know that the people who inhabit the places we brand are people who use our services. We don't say need, they use our services because they have no other option. So those are the tensions that exist between us and some of the, and some of the law societies. Some law societies are very good. We cooperate very well with them. Now, I want to go over to client and community sectors that we looked at, which we thought had an impact on our services and how we should deal with them in terms of crafting strategies. The first one that I mentioned is the high level of poverty and unemployment, which impacts directly on the demand for legal aid. I mentioned recently in a conference held by the DSO that poverty remains a fatal hunting ground for the big criminal gangs, particularly those involved in syndicates and money laundering, particularly hijacking. They target disaffected youth, which is unemployed. And unfortunately, it is those people who get arrested, and it is those people that we represent as a legal aid board. I was mentioning this in the context that it should provide an opportunity to the DSO in analyzing the cases we handle of these so-called foot soldiers in terms of how they could develop their own strategies against the big kingpin in that sector. Another factor that I mentioned in client and community sector is in relation to the shrinkage in available donor funding and an increase in the demand on the legal aid board to provide services. The donor funding that is shrinking for the NGO sector, particularly the advice offices and community legal centers. Those provided very good services to our communities, but the funding that they had access to is drying up. And in their space, there's a growing expectation, particularly in the civil legal aid, that the legal aid board should do what they have been doing. We've mentioned in this committee the issue of accessibility in rural areas, because we think there's a big unmet demand there. And then we've looked at the increase in the level of crimes against women and children. And I've mentioned the civil legal aid part. We then looked at other sectors, such as sectors in our internal environment. I don't mean to spend time on these ones, but I've set them out in the document. Particularly in our legal services delivery, we've analyzed what our strengths are and what our weaknesses are. The chair has asked us for a map which shows where our justice centers and our satellite offices are. So we've looked at that as a strength, that our national coverage and geographic spread, which provides access of clients, is okay, but we lack a general legal advisory service, particularly in terms of a paralegal capacity to help us in those centers. You will see in another slide, I think I'll come to it, where we've reviewed our national footprint of justice centers. We have 58 around the country. And we think we can add to those numbers, because having established all of them, other areas that need our services direly and which we try to cover with judicial have indicated to us that we need to establish justice centers in those areas. So those are the internal factors. And then I'm not going to spend time on the internal support platform. That's what we have internally in terms of the capacity we've created to enable us to provide our services. And then in doing that, we've identified a number of strategic risks that we have to look at and take strategic initiatives to make sure that we don't expose ourselves unnecessarily. We think it was good for us to identify them. These are divided into internal as well as a combination of both. I'm not going to spend time on them, but among the external ones, you've got the court efficiency and the integrity of the legal system. We know that there's always a criticism of the criminal justice system in terms of the delay in prosecuting matters, in terms of the high number of withdrawals of cases and the confidence, or the impact of this in the confidence of the judge as to the effectiveness of the criminal justice system in particular. We've listed in the internal risk the quality of legal services that we offer. I've mentioned to you the impact of the non-aligned salaries on our services. That we recognize as a risk. I think going further, we also looked at what was the environment within which we crafted our policies. We thought that was also relevant in terms of us crafting strategies. The first one that we recognize that obviously the Constitution has to be taken into account. I just want to mention another aspect that we looked at in terms of the policy framework. The Legal Services Charter in particular. We've become involved in the process of drafting the Legal Services Charter. But I was disappointed, and I think almost all of us in the Legal Aid Board were disappointed. Because when the first draft of the Legal Services Charter was circulated, the portion on legal aid was a portion that referred to a pre-1999 situation. And we were surprised at this, that at this day and age, when everyone knows what we do, we are there, they will still put a document that has those cases. Well, maybe that's why we now have a chief of operations, so that our CEO will now be a lot more out there, you know. But we were disappointed about that aspect. But anyway, I think our main concern with the Legal Services Charter, which we've taken up, I think, in the submissions that we've given, is that there is an inadequate focus on the transformation of how legal services are to be delivered to clients. We think there's too much of a preoccupation with how lawyers can best look after themselves in that section. And that's why they want to sort of take control of that process. And we also have a concern as to how, what are the transformative initiatives that the document can have in terms of how legal services can be made accessible to the millions of South Africans who need those. We also looked at the Legal Aid Act. I've mentioned this earlier on, that the Legal Aid Act is one of our documents that gives us a mandate, but it's an old document. It's a pre-constitutional document. The reason that we have a number of policies and we have quite a number of revisions to our Legal Aid Guide is because we're trying to bring that act in line with the Constitution. So we adopted the view that perhaps it's time that a new Legal Aid Act was promulgated. And as I've stated, we've had dealings with the Deputy Minister as to how that process can unfold. The Legal Aid Guide situation, I've mentioned it. Although I must say it appears that maybe this year we may see some difference in terms of whether our Legal Aid Guide will be ratified by Parliament, because I think for the first time we've been called by the NCOP to go and appear before them. We think that may be an indication that that document has reason. But it remains a concern to us that this is a document that is key. It is like the legal aid Bible in this country, but we continue to operate by secular. Chair, I think without going further into, because the other stuff are just the strategic outcomes and objectives, but what I need to say is that in our strategic initiative, we've adopted what we call the balanced scorecard approach. The CEO, because he has more time than I do, because I'm also a judge, he can tell you more about what the balanced scorecard is and what it does and stuff like that. But in a nutshell, if you see from that slide, we looked at the outcomes and we detailed them into objectives, right? And then we had four components of the balanced scorecard. The scorecard which was adopted. One was the client, community, stakeholder, and shareholder part. Second one, finance and sustainability. I think the finance and sustainability aspect, particularly on the finance side, incorporating governance issues and stuff, is what has stood us in good stead, because we've made sure that we continue to be vigilant on that front to make sure that we account properly for the funds we get from the fiscal. And then, of course, business processes and then employee and organizational capacity. And then those are the outcomes and objectives that you see on that slide. I don't want to bore you with the details. My board member, Vincent, Valdana calls this like the scrambled egg. He's the best to talk about it, but I think it's just there to show you how the outcomes and the objectives interlink with each other, also links to our vision and mission, as well as to the strategies that we initially crafted. I want to close off by then telling you finally what the strategies that we adopted are. We adopted three strategies, which are very key to what we do. The first one is to deliver quality legal services and to promote the protection and defense of our constitutional rights. I think that's the main and key strategy of the Legal Aid Board. That's where that strategy on its own consumes more than close to a third, I think, of the funding that we receive, because that's where the lawyers are and all the other initiatives. And then we have the next one, which is to develop and maintain the human capital to support the delivery of quality legal services. That's our staffing and other human resources initiatives. And then the third and last strategy is to develop and maintain the institutional capacity to support the delivery of quality legal services. Here we're talking about our IT platform and things like that. So we are happy that these three strategies will carry us for the next 3 years. We've looked at everything conceivable that we had to look at. If you look at the next slide, that is on strategy one, that's exactly what that strategy entails. That's all the detail I won't talk to you about, particularly the document you have, as well as the second and third strategy. And then, in addition to these strategies, we've then come up with programs to say, or to make sure that those strategies are achieved, what sort of progress do we put? I mean, if you look at the legal services delivery one, we've got a problem of increasing access. We've got a problem of increasing quality, time of delivery, etc., etc. And then in the second strategy, the organizational culture, we've got to continuously work and ensure that the views of our employees as to the Legal Aid Board and them being in the Legal Aid Board continue being on the positive side. That's all the programs, and then the last page of the slide deals with the matrix, which sets out everything: the vision, the mission, the strategies, the outcomes, the progress. So, Chair, that's my side of things. I want to assure the committee that this strategic formulation process took a long time. It took over a year, I think, because we had to come in to consult widely. We consulted through our justice centers with the communities we serve. And then we then went to regional regions. We also invited the DOJ. I know the Chief of Operations of the Department of Justice attended one of our sessions and made input. But we made sure that in crafting this strategic document, we also look at what the strategic initiatives of the other main role players were in the justice sector, particularly Department of Justice, NPA, Correctional Services. And once we had finalized our strategic document, we submitted it to the Department of Justice and invited them to make comments, if any, just to make sure that we play open cards and we strive for alignment in what we do. If they establish cause, they should know that it has an impact on us. And they should tell us timely where, and it should give us an opportunity to decide at what point we ask for more money to cover those areas. So, Chair, thank you very much. That's my side. We ever say we are happy that this strategic initiative will carry us for the next 3 years. We review it, though, every year. But we would welcome any input from this committee about areas that we may have overlooked in formulating this strategic document. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Judge, for the very comprehensive overview. I think that's very good. Members would have to receive the documents, particularly the documents that she was speaking to at this time. And I wanted to, seeing as we have sufficient time today, I told you we were going to run out of time to us. But I see that it's just your part and the CEO of the Commission. Thank you. us some of the details around the judge's input. So if you want specific information, I suggest that you wait for us, and that is what you've been doing, is just literally wasting time. So try and confine your questions to the broad issues that the judge raised, and perhaps some of the specific issues that you might want to inquire about. And let's then take a round of questions. I've got the two cameras first. I've got Ms. Johnson, Mr. Yuber, Mr. Sivanyone, and Iman Solomon. Sorry, Mr. Swan. You look very much at how I'm a legal let's start with Mr. Swan and then go to the chat.
How many questions?
Two.
Thank you for the judge. Thank you for the comprehensive input submission. Could I just ask, as far as the progress regarding the civil matter content, what is happening in that regard? I do appreciate that at this stage, any work that you might be doing in this regard would relate to an unfunded mandate. You could give us an indication of that. And then you did refer to developments on the restorative justice concept. Would you just explain a little bit further? We do understand from the NCA side that they are making use of diversion and loss. How does that impact on your PAs, particularly in the light of the absence as yet of the child justice bill? But we do see that diversion is taking place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shah. Short and sweet, Mrs. Kammer.
Thank you. The first question on the strategy two. Which is develop and maintain the human capital to support the delivery of quality services, and that is expanded on a subsequent page. Just wanted to ask you, possibly all of us have received this letter from South African Parish, State and Tertiary Institutions Union complaining about the salaries of the legal aid lawyers, professional assistants and administrators.
It
was a letter to the minister, and I presume we'd all been copied with it because I received a copy, and it's several pages complaining about the salaries in their first instance, comparing them with the NPA. You do make the point yourself that the NPA salaries are somewhat higher. And then the...
What's the question, Mrs. Sandler?
Well, is this... Look, I had the presentation on the one hand saying that the staff is important. I then get this letter complaining about the low level. I'd like the chair to just tell us how, you know, is this a problem? How are they going to deal with it? Do they have a strategy in place to deal with the sort of problem, with the complaints that have been raised with us? I presumed it was all about this. Yeah. So that's the first one. And then on the impact of... justice sector taxes, the impact of minimum sentencing legislation. You said we've reached certain conclusions. We've seen its effect, the compartmentalization of certain circumstances and stuff, but you didn't elaborate. And I wondered if you give us an idea of what the Legal Aid Board's view is of this legislation and what you think ought to happen. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. This is on the issue of the legal services charter. Jeff, you said that it was the details were outdated and flawed and it was inadequate when focusing on transformation. Just if you could some of the details and some of the specifics that you'd like to see in the charter. And then secondly, I think before there was a case saying that people who face eviction orders and land reform cases in certain instances are entitled to legal aid. I'm just wondering if the board provides that. And whether you're geared to provide legal aid to such people. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The judge said that they aim at 1.5 PAs per court. Now, I would just like to know what percentage of criminal cases is dealt with by the legal aid board. Because obviously, the prosecutors handle 100% of Then my second question is, the judge mentioned that presiding officers prefer legal aid practitioners to duty care lawyers. Is that a perception or a fact? Can you just elaborate on that, please? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chef. And just the first question relates to the accreditation of legal practitioners. Because it would appear that nowadays a private practitioner needs to be accredited first before he can do legal aid work. Then the question is, how long does the process take? In view of some cases of the matter, suppose a private practitioner receives instructions, and then before he can be instructed, he has to be accredited by the legal board. Are there some delays? Yes or no? And then secondly, the question of who decides in practice. Suppose a practitioner, legal practitioner, refers or says at the court that is, you can ask for legal aid if that particular client asks for legal aid. Will the client be referred to the practitioner, or will that client be referred to the PA, who is at some court always available to the court? I see it as a court for the case.
Thank you, Jefferson. Jefferson, in your report, I mean, you recognize separately stakeholding the criminal justice sector. Obviously, you know, particularly targets those people who are in need of legal aid. The first contact is with the police, right? And I would like to know, are the police cooperating with the legal aid board in, you know, to see that those who are in need of legal aid, that their constitutional right is upheld. Secondly, I think this is what refers to this, that is the sole legal aid. In your kind of legal practice here, you have here two bullet points. We talk about the high level of poverty, and also the maximum condition of someone who has for legal aid. I think you really have a good motivation here for the need of civil legal aid here. Because this can affect, you know, really people's lives here, you know, their homes, their properties, you know, and also family. From what I hear, I mean, you have, you know, given the Justice Department your side of the story as far as civil legal aid is concerned, you know, and the need for this, more so, you know, because of the legal perspective here. What do you think was more must be done here for us, from us here, right, in order to get the thing going? I also feel it's very important to get this aspect of legal aid.
Imam is the
prosecutor here.
I think that they're one of the issues that we must obviously deal with the deals of personal profession. The first is obviously the and thank you for the fact that we should see just across the government. But I'll certainly have a look at it. And I don't think anything could be done between policy and legal aid boards and having discussions on these things. Because as much as you say the legislation will come from the legislature, it's open up the place of community. And I think the sooner that happens, the better. And I'll certainly have a look at this, and we'll try and devise between ourselves an opportunity. It may not even be this young, it's like a substantial liberty program. We'll certainly try and make some time. This is on the very Christian issue. I don't think that the view is essentially that it shouldn't be so. I think that what we're worried about, as we have continuously the priority given to criminal work. What is the quality of criminal work that is actually being done at the level of? Should we not focus on that priority and then look at what can be done? And I think, you know, the expansion of civil work, I see in the, I was reading this document yesterday, quite late last night, and I came across, I can't remember what heading it was, but there were things like
one we have is Human Rights Commissioner Tony Matthews. And I think that those actually also need to deal with that in terms of co-opting a relationship or developing relationships with these other institutions that will deal with these other issues. Because frankly, the issue of rights across the board is within, involved within the purview of the Human Rights Commission. They've got adequate funding to adjudicate on these matters. Why is it that we see the legal state board as an umbrella body for providing legal services on behalf of the state? And I think that there needs to be some discussion around that. You know, what can be done to have a developed relationship there? So I don't want to enter into the debate today. All I'm saying is that I think, as I said last year and the year before, I think that we need a forum to discuss these things properly. We can't do it when you come here to report on your annual statements and so on. We do need a determined effort, I think, so I will certainly undertake to read this document. I'm sure members already, I guess most of you have it. You'll have a look at this and you'll certainly find some time in our program and our lives which we have begun. You'll come down if you need to be to come and have a discussion with you on those issues. The legal aid guide, certainly another big area that we need to concern ourselves with. In a process that I suppose you could tell that a long time. If you'd let me know about it during the course of the year, we could have made investigations. And I think that's really another broad area that I do want to cover. One of the things that I think we tend to get roped into, and this goes to other institutions that we oversee as well, is that we tend to all gear up for one opportunity a year to engage with each other and really don't make effective use of the relationship that we have with each other and our relationship with the department as an overseeing body. If you had come and written to me and said, this report is now overdue and so on, we would have been able to report back to you on the situation. So I think that we must make more use of the fact that the committee is here and will address certain concerns, especially as it relates to the Department of Justice. We don't have the capacity, as I said yesterday to the team, we don't have the capacity to call you up and say, what about this, what about that? I'm sitting with Mr. DC with my capacity. And we oversee about 23 different justice centers. And it's just absolutely impossible, together with our legal system program and other communities, it's impossible for us to be following up with these stuff. So really the responsibility will lie with you. And we be the active subject. So you have that opportunity, please make me. On the issue of the unequal resources, you know, this is something that we will champion quite vehemently, and we are doing so. You're more than a judge, you're also a diplomat. If you don't indicate what the real problems are with regard to the issue of the balance salary, being just one area of it. Of course, the differential resourcing of property as well as the legal aid. One of the things that I don't really see in the documents that you've given to us and definitely asked that those who prepared is a comparative analysis of the differential funding. And I think more and more this is going to become a big issue, particularly when it comes to the salary issue. You mentioned that the problem with the salary disparity is that the prosecuting authority and the department seems to pay their people more, people who are similarly qualified to those people that you employ. The problem, of course, is that they're all catching up with the magistrate salary. And the one problem that nobody seems to, other than the committee, seems to raise on a constant basis is that you cannot have magistrate salaries being determined without reference, completely without reference to similarly qualified people in the rest of the government. And I sit on the Magistrates Commission. I see how some of your people come and apply there to become traffic court magistrates for the next 3 or 4 years, simply because the salaries are So that is something that we will want to champion with you, but we will need some, I think, comparative studies from yourself in terms of the actual salary of the I've asked the NPA to do is to give me the different levels in terms of the actual salary paid, perhaps at an entry level, and further down the line. And then last year we spoke about career pathing. Maybe you want to talk to us a little bit about those initiatives. You did say to us last year very broadly that you have done initiatives in terms of trying to keep people in the legal industry. What exactly have you done in that regard? I see that there's been a whole lot of promotions in terms of, I'm not sure if that's the only strategy that you have to think about. Whole lot of questions from members. Happy for you to expand those questions out to different people if you wish.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the words of encouragement, particularly on the areas I've highlighted, which are problematic to us. That's what I mean when I say we always leave this committee heartened by the understanding that this committee has of the environment we operate under and what needs to be done. So thank you very much for that. I will give you some of the questions, and some people in my team will also assist. I think broadly speaking on civil legal aid, the question is, what is the progress? What has to happen? Chair, the injunction in the Constitution is on the state to provide legal aid. And the legal aid has chosen, the state has chosen the legal aid board to the agency to provide, to respond to that constitutional injunction. And the way the state has done it is to say the legal aid board is independent in terms of what it has to do. We are on the ground as a legal aid. We see the need. We talk to the people who come to us to seek our services regarding civil legal aid. So when we say there's a need for the provision of civil legal aid, it's based on that experience. Because of the sort of uncertain and I would say mixed messages that sometimes we get from government in particular. I refer in this regard to a comment made by the DG of Justice in our conference last year that he's not in favor of the legal aid for providing civil legal aid. This provides mixed messages for us to say what should be happening. We've had a debate with this committee where the committee, as you rightly say, Chair, that the committee has never said there's no need for civil legal aid. But what has been looked at has other priorities fulfilled. That's true. So in an effort to make sure that there's progress and finality as to whether we provide civil legal aid as a legal aid board, we spoke to the minister and she asked for that certificate. She said that it must be properly reset. I think what we have is the executive summary, if I'm not mistaken. We have a full document. It sets out the whole spectrum of what we looked at to justify our statement that there's a need for civil legal aid. My view is, we think there should be civil legal aid. We think we've got the know-how, let me put it that way, of the environment, and we think we can do it. The only problem is, because of this prioritization of criminal legal aid, the expectation, as you also point out, is that we should do whatever has to be done to make sure that we are on top of that particular aspect before we can look at other things. I'm not sure if that's possible, but that's a different debate. What we're saying is, we can relegate a need which is dire simply because we think we are not properly up to speed regarding the other aspects. As matters stand, we think we are responding properly. We've covered every inch of South Africa in terms of the need for criminal legal aid. There are other issues that are there, but it has nothing to do with access. So we think we are there. But as I said,
we don't have to convince ourselves that we're there for us to start taking civil legal aid. We think on a progressive basis, civil legal aid needs to be provided. We can't quantify the need now, but we know that the need is very big. But we have indications from the Justice Center as to the number of people who approach them. We've got civil PAs in almost all our justice centers, but their capacity is limited. There's more. We can't use a lot of our budget to start judicial lawyers to attend to civil matters because it will have a direct impact. So it's a combination of all those factors that I say leave us with a problem. So look, we know there's a need. We see the people, they qualify in terms of our systems. We've got to assist them. But where our funding is gobbled up by the criminal part of things, is a problem for us. We don't want to trace that aspect, but we also think the other aspect needs to be attended. So by those comments, I'm basically saying, I'm reaching a stage where I'm saying the government or the state must answer to the Constitution, just like they did in Westminster. They must answer to the Constitution. We think we must provide civil legal aid. But if they think otherwise, if they think there should be another legal aid board or another organization that provides civil legal aid, just like the format, I think they should come out to the office. Let's make sure there's progress and finality as to what has to happen in this answer. I think that's my view.
I don't know if Dr. Mario wants to add to that.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. Let me just add to a comment that Chair has made.
I can't hear you.
I have the...
Put it straight again, yeah.
Okay, the better.
Mm-hmm.
So I shout. but perhaps I should start by... by clearing up what often appears as a misconception in this debate around civil legal aid.
I think you must leave that other mic on closer.
Okay, any comments?
No.
Both.
Oh, double barrel.
Sound on that outer line.
Can I be heard now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I think it's the angle. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Just to add to what Judge Rambo said, first, I think it's important to address a misconception, a common misconception around this issue, and that is that civil legal aid, for some reason, is a creature of the legal aid board. I think that's a complete misconception. In fact, it's not the legal aid board which has created the need nor the notion of civil legal aid, but it actually comes out of Parliament itself. And as that
the legal aid board never refused and never objected.
If you allow me to complete that. The need for providing services is constitutionally mandated, and I think Judge covered that in his earlier presentation. But if you look at the document which has been circulated to members and which Chair will be handed now, there are a number of pieces of legislation that emanate from Parliament which have actually put the legal aid board on the spot as well. So, for example, if you look at the question of Labour Relations Act, 649,
Professor Bata, I hate to interrupt, but I don't think we should be going through the documents now. I think members, particularly in this committee...
If you allow me to share...
Hang on, Professor Bata. This is a parliamentary committee, and you are under the subjection of the chair. And I want to suggest that you don't proceed along the line that you're proceeding. Because what you're doing is you're giving us a background. The argument with this committee has never been that you don't have a legislative mandate. The argument has been on a different trend. So I want to suggest that you don't take us through the documents and the various arguments. But I'm going to allow you a few minutes to just to complete what you were about to do when you said that you're going to add to what the judge was saying upon this matter. So, you can proceed now.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I wasn't actually intending to lead you through any document, but just to highlight that, in fact, they are intelligence which arise out of Parliament, laws which have been passed here, which actually necessitate legal aid boards to actually enter the arena of provision of civil legal aid. So, I think that the thrust of what the legal aid board is saying is that it's not really a question of whether civil legal aid should be provided, but in fact, on what terms, how that actually is happening. And I'm glad that, in fact, what I'm hearing this morning from some members who've spoken, that the notion of civil legal aid is something which is all they accept them, it's not a matter of debate. So when the legal aid board put forward its proposal, we did so on the basis of getting the principle and the broad issues accepted. And of course, the legal aid board, I'm sure, would be more than happy to sort of look at the mechanics of how a rollout of legal aid would actually take place. So I think we've sort of made that distinction. But I think in keeping with the sort of constitutional mandate, the board's view is that we should look at, well, we have one of two choices. Either we're going to roll out civil legal aid as a proactive measure, or we're going to find a situation where increasingly demands are made on the state to provide legal aid in civil matters, and that would fairly likely be an unfavorable term, such as in the court order and so on. So I think the board's position to sum up on the question of civil legal aid is that it would be advisable to enter this arena on terms which are sort of acceptable to the board, acceptable to the state, essentially meaning that civil legal aid would have to be rolled up incrementally, not all at once, right? I think there are obligations to realize this on a progressive basis, and that the issue of available resources obviously comes into operation here. I think, again, that's a matter which will have to be looked at in some detail. There's lots of jurisprudence nationally and internationally which says that it's not enough just to say that, look, we don't have the resources, but in fact there's an obligation on the state to put forward a plan as to how the rollout would have an incremental, how it would be achieved. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I think the question here is, well, there's good motivation, there are all these documents, what is happening? I think video in her presentation will give you some depth as to the cases we're doing. But it is, in a sense, I'll put it in quotes, it's a bit of an unfunded mandate, so to speak, for support to find the money to respond to the cases we get. But I think once we are in a position where we feel the constraints that are there are no longer there, we'll be in a better position to provide it incrementally, as Professor Bowder said. I think that's what I can say on civil legal aid. Is there, if there's anything I've not covered, please just highlight that to me. In terms of the salaries, as to where, what are we doing to alleviate the problem, we provide increases in line with what the government does. But in terms of this readjustment, we don't have the funds to also adjust our salaries to reach what the NPA and the DOJ, in terms of their state attorneys and state advocates, have done, is a problem. That's why I say there are rumblings of industrial action of sorts that we may be facing. We do have business contingency plans in place in case we are hit with industrial action. We have those plans. But I think that doesn't absolve anyone from attending to this problem. I think that's my answer regarding the salaries. The minimum sentencing legislation, I think the question that was asked was, what is our view? I don't want to go into detail about this. There's a lot of submissions were made before, I think, the last extension of that legislation. I think you go to any of our PAs, I talk to them a lot when I meet them, and they will tell you that the biggest problem is you'll find that, say, the life sentence has become the norm for a number of different offenses. Some of them, in the normal course of these events, when you put them on the same place, you can realize that life in that particular one was not satisfied. But because that's what the legislation says, if you can't come to the standard of minimum and substantial, you're out, you've got to get life. I think that's one example I can give. There are a lot of other examples about the inequities that have come out of that legislation.
Are you saying that the application of that legislation is something to be desired, or
you
think that the legislation itself is what they're complaining about?
Well, it's a combination of both, because sometimes you'll have the Supreme Court of Appeal correcting the misapplication of that legislation by lower courts. You'll have it. But the other broader aspect is the constraining of judicial officers to say,
these offense of committed diseases, serious, and these are the broad factors, therefore, this act is applicable. And you can't go outside until a certain standard is met in terms of what mitigation you can provide. So I think it's a combination of both. So
it's well, one mistaken one, of course, you would remind the case that the legislation was found to be constitutional not once, but twice.
That's true, Chef. It has been found constitutional, but we...
If there are, let me just invite you, if there are practical issues that you want to raise regarding the implementation and the way in which the law perhaps, as you say, sometimes the Supreme Court has to correct the misapplication of that legislation, and if you have some concrete proposals to make, one of the things that we are doing reviewing that legislation committee this year. I invite you through your experiences with the PA's experience court and so on to make those proposals to us so that we can look at it and review that legislation. To that extent, we really put into it to look at how we can improve as
possible. Thank you, Chair. I think let me just close that aspect by saying I would think that legislation is as a result of the outcry at the high crime level. I'm not sure whether the stage is now set, whether it can be reviewed, whether the situation can be reviewed to say, has that legislation had an impact on that or not? But
the legislation was not necessarily only in this one. It was part of the response here. But there's also a huge problem. Reduce the severity in sentences that emanate from courts around similar offenses. And that's really part of the underlying that when we frame that legislation, we're very much aware of, and particularly in this country where we have a past such as ours, it becomes a very important thing that we see some synergies with regard to things. And we're not, certainly not in the vicinity of this stage of a mind.
Thank you, Chair. As I said, I think I've said my piece about it, and but I'll just respond to your question. I think a broader review needs to be looked at as to the desirability or what effect that legislation has had. But that's the subject of another debate as well. In terms of the legal services charter,
the question on the legal services charter was what was it that we would like to put into it. We have given written submissions collecting all of it and suggesting a complete rewrite of the Access to Justice chapter. And we're hoping that in the focus working group that has been now set up, that we will be able to include that. But we also think that the entire thrust of the charter should be more on access to justice rather than on transforming the profession and the sector from a ownership and a legal professional's demographic point of view. That is important, but I think access to justice is equally important, so that's the issue there.
You now sit on that task force too.
They've established it, but we still need to.
But
we weren't part of the drafting team, but we said that we should have been included.
Yeah,
I'm asking whether you're now formally a member of the Formally, we've been invited. With regard to the question on evictions and land reform and whether we're here to provide legal assistance, at this stage, as part of the civil matters that we do deal with, we are dealing with matters related to ESCA and evictions on the one hand. On the other hand, we also have partnerships with NGOs involved with delivering legal services in land matters, and in some instances through our cooperation partners we also are working with them. And thirdly, as far as land reform is concerned, we're also in the process of setting up an agreement with the Land Claims Commission where they want us to represent people who would need legal representation, and we are at the stage where we finalize an agreement where they will make some funds available so that it adds to our funding for that type of net.
You must let us have copies of that.
think, Brian, I would like to deal with the question about the 1.5 PA per court as to the percentage of cases that we do as opposed to the percentage of cases done by the NPA.
Thank you. The delivery board, in terms of its representation in district reach from High Court, we have just completed a study whereby we analyzed over a 3 to 4 month period the percentage of cases on the court roll that we actually consume or we actually have, or supply services to. And we found that it ranges the district court between 60 and 75% of the cases. In the regional court, it's still much higher. The High Court is almost 90 to 100% in some areas. You find also that in the study that we have done, you may see some of the stats that come out. A large percentage of cases are withdrawn, but we look at the timing of the withdrawals, and the timing ranges from very early in the first quarter of the case, but in many cases it's actually extended to the latter part of the case. So you'll find the consumption of services of legal aid board practitioners is quite high. It may not be on the same level as the prosecutors who sit, through every case, but it's such that it's impossible for practitioners to be able to be conducting cases on a daily basis without having sufficient time to prepare. So we have various ratios in mind that we have actually been advocating. At the last meeting of the committee last year, we did actually provide the comparisons in terms of ratios, where the NPA is and where the legal aid board is. We have progressively been trying to use whatever additional funding we get, and you'll see it again in the report by the CEO, to increase the ratio that we have. We're pleased to say that with the additional funding we had during the latter part of last year, we have now implemented in the regional court a ratio of 1.25 PAs per court. So this does give us some capacity to get our practitioners to spend more time doing quality work. But we found so far it's inadequate. We'd like to move to 1.5 in the regional court as the minimum, and the district court moves between 1 and 1.25. At the moment, our capacity in the district court varies from 0.5, I think the practitioner may take 2 courts as in span of operation, to 0.75. So we're finding gaps. So the study we did actually has revealed quite some interesting data. The board is going to review this at the meeting that we are having end of this month. And based on that may inform the way we actually motivate for additional resources in the new period of the MCAT cycle.
Thank you, Brian. I think the rectorate is just this question that I didn't answer.
We just wanted to clarify that where we listed factors in the earlier part of the strategic plan, we were documenting new initiatives or changes that were taking place, not necessarily that we have ourselves done a lot of it. But we are interested in the restorative justice concept from a public defender point of view, especially in terms of a mindset which says that the only action in response to crime shouldn't be punitive, it should also be how we reintegrate people back into our society. So as we progress, we will be looking at how we can do more on that. We are cooperating in those instances where there are pilots, for example, at the PE Integrated Justice Center type of system to look at those diversions, but we would like to do more, and we haven't had the capacity to do that, but it's on our own.
Thank you, Chair. On the perception regarding Justice Center PAs for judicare, I'm not going to answer this, but I know that it's not perception, in fact, that it's facts. But can I ask one of my RAs, Mr. Mtaji, here, I'm sure he can deal with it, that judicial officers actually prefer our justice center to aid the judiciary?
Thank you, Chair. On the ground, what is happening is, because the presiding officers know the continuous availability of a practitioner, they rather prefer that practitioner be the one who appears at court. In various instances, we give judicare practitioners an instruction when they postpone the cases various occasions that they never really get to be ready, and the trial officers then ultimately complain to us at the various health centers that rather your internal attorney than the judicare attorney, because my role, then you begin to create backlogs because of the unavailability. That is what is happening on the ground in various health centers and I'm sure in other regions too that happens.
Presents an opportunity for the legal aid board, surely. Wouldn't they contract and adjudicate them to make sure that part of that agreement is some degree of political control around availability when they pay them the number of opportunities to postpone the trial? It's not the first time we've heard about problems around attorneys and trial practice. We hear constantly from judicial officers that people just don't turn up. Very little you can do under those circumstances, but that's from the court. And clearly it seems to me that this is not just a matter that the legal aid board can influence in positive ways with regard to its own functionality and its own ability to finalize cases, but also with the enormous contribution to the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the accreditation question that was asked, I think I'll ask Brian to deal with it because that falls under him.
Thanks, Judge. So just to any perception that judicial attorneys or other practitioners don't bring cases to the legal aid board. In fact, well, the normal course of events is that a client would apply for legal aid and depending on their qualifications, and the Justice Center will then decide whether they take it in-house or they want to allocate it to a private practitioner. They would use various criteria in making the decision. One would be, for instance, if there's any conflict of interest, and it would, on other, it could be a random basis to ensure that a portion of the work is allocated privately. So the accreditation of practitioners doesn't really pose the problem, but we have an ongoing basis of inviting private practitioners to participate in our judicial scheme, and the moment they apply, the actual process of getting onto the roll or to our rotation list is not actually long. It doesn't take more than a couple of days. And then it will be dependent on when on the list the next matter is allocated that you will get the post. So in terms of accreditation, that this will show out that it's the discretion of the Justice Center in terms of whether the matter goes out. There are cases, however, when a matter is already being parted and the client runs out of funds, when we will then look at the attorney as the person that we'd like to contact. It makes sense to actually get the same person the case. And in those cases, we will fast-track the accreditation process to ensure that cases are not actually delayed.
The other question related to the cooperation that our PA gave from the SAPS, are you able to deal with that?
As far as our work with the SAPS is concerned, yes, I think it is important because they do have the first contact with clients. And what we did try in the last financial year is a pilot whereby we had our PAs on standby on call when people were arrested and needed legal aid. However, it's actually quite difficult to do that because we have 48 justice centers, we have about 1,500 lawyers, and there's 1,000 police stations across the country. In terms of access, etc., it actually is quite difficult. But at the regional level, from staff management, we had good cooperation. From a station level, at the police station itself, it's the cooperation is not that good because obviously, when they arrest people, they want to get as much as they can, and they don't really want us to interfere. So what we found, in fact, is that the extent to which our practitioners were called out was very low, and in fact, that system just didn't work. If it did work, and we had to roll it out nationally, so that cost us quite a lot. Anyway. So we don't think we can continue that. However, what we now have and working with TAPT on is that through the Justice Plus initiative, is that they, as part of the setting up of the IT systems across the cluster, is that when an arrest is made, we will have a link, and that's not set up yet, but we want to move towards that if the money has become available, is that when an arrest is made, they will send us a trigger on their system, which we'll pick up on our system, which says that the arrest is made, and we then brief our practitioners so that they can then pick up on those clients that will need legally, and we think that will work. However, they said that they make over 2 million arrests a year. So that's going to be quite a big load on our system, and we'll have to then further that. But that's what we're moving towards, and that's, I think that's the advance of technology, that we can use that to see how we can improve access.
Around just before you move off this, around the bail application,
just get Brian and our regional executives to answer. We do get involved in bail applications, but there's huge difficulties.
Thanks, Jefferson. Just to assure committee that bail applications and providing legal assistance for bail core part of our service included in every practitioner's mandate, including the private practitioner. One of the is a problem, and you'll see from the stats in terms of outcomes that we do. The percentage of cases that we close because of that category. So there's not much we can actually do in a one-week. So we close the matter if a one-week arrest has actually been given in the private counsel.
Let me ask you, because you see, one of the big problems that we have it'd be very good to see that kind of thing emanating from this. Something has to be done about it. And the prosecuting authority is unable to do the verification based on the fact that those are not kind of things. It would seem to me to be an area of illegal execution, and certainly next year we will require you to report back and give us some feedback on this.
Just on the part where the tension may have been mentioned between us and the professional body, I can refer to one example. You see, the work we do, our PAs have no agendas in doing the work they do, but private practitioners, their motivation is to make money or to get a fee. I'm saying this just to illustrate one particular example. Brian mentioned that there are a number of postponements. I used to be a high court judge in Dover. You'd find the judicial practitioner coming to my flat at 10 to 4 and saying, please sign here as the judge's flat that this case was postponed and put the time. That has implications for us, because if the time is 10 to 4, half past 3, then he must end his fee for that day. So there are a number of things that these guys get to. But I think you're right, Chair, that we need to sort of investigate and come up with ways of dealing with the quality assurance measures as far as judicial practitioners are concerned. We will look at the comparative analysis of the salaries in the criminal justice sector. But Brian, don't you kind of give the committee an idea of what the situation is? Because I think we know what's happening.
Thanks, Judge. Second, to just indicate that we didn't do a comparative study of salaries without actually giving you the full details, because we don't have the tables yet, to say that we fall very short, especially in the entry level of the profession. And that is where many of our candidate trainees will become professional assistants, and they take up positions with the legal aid board because we like to retain our IFI. They often salaries 50,000 plus. More at, for instance, the MTA, and we just can't hold on to that. In the upper levels, where especially in the ICOS, where our ICOS and the TAs work with their counterparts, state advocates, the salary discrepancy is huge. And in the middle, in between those two, then the differential is not as high. But we have done the study. Just to also indicate to the committee that there is a process that is currently unfolding, coordinated by the DPSA to look at lining of salaries. And they have actually mapped a process that will hopefully lead to alignment second half of this year. The expectation of the process for our practitioners is quite high. We are committed that we are doing everything we can to support the process. We can't be assured that other sectors have got the same interest, because they have only realized whatever they have wanted from the future. But we are hopeful that that will lead to some alignment in the cluster, and it will stop the movement of PAs across the stakeholders.
I think what you need to do is to give us a comparative across the board, and not just for the MPA. Because you see, we owe that report, this committee has owed that report by the Department of Justice, the administration, and the PAs. The alignment of salaries within public sector as a whole is something that they need to retain. What they can't retain is if you have the determination of magistrate salaries in the public sector. And that's what's happening currently. Although the legislation says that when you determine magistrate salaries, there has to be cognizant based on synergy between some of the qualified people in public sector. It doesn't appear to be the situation to get a little bit. So what's happening is, as far as you're concerned, these people earn higher, so they shouldn't really be moving anything much forward. But the problem is the magistrate. The prosecutors are losing enormous amounts to the magistrate. We were told that of the vacancies that were advertised last year, quite a substantial number of vacancies that the magistrate managed, as 80% of those were filled by prosecutors. Now, that's a big crisis for them, and they're not going to, stagnate in those studies. Now what's going to happen is that there's a forward movement trying to close the gap between the prosecutors and magistrates. This year, again, the first proposal of 15% increase above the car allowance, the 60% that they got in the previous year. So that movement is ever forward. And what we need to do is we need to have a holistic strategy, which is what we call for, and that's why the DPSA and these people are getting involved. But the problem is that you're continuously going to have this problem as magistrate salaries get pushed upwards. So we need to find some kind of cohesive understanding. So I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that we have equal salaries, because that's what people have been reporting that I've been saying. Equal salaries is not necessarily probably the best way to go, but certainly there needs to be some equity, some synergy around it, so that if you have a public defender and a public prosecutor who's been in that position for
have a magistrate who's been there for 2 years. You know, it shouldn't be that they understand something. And so there needs to be this broader discussion. And what I'm saying is that you don't just look at yourselves and the NPA, because that's not the problem. The problem is they have a problem in terms. And so there is this synergy. So for your own purposes, this debate is going to happen at some stage. And particularly with this independent commission. Because I think that unless you understand that the problem emanates from there, you're not going to be addressing the entire issue. So it's going to really depend. We will certainly apply pressure as much as we can. As you know, our salaries also get determined by that education commission. So when we start making noises, it looks like sour grapes. But you are the cold face of where this problem is actually manifested. And so you really need to be a little more vocal and perhaps more interactive and addressing some of your documentation, some of your steps to that commission for their information every time they look. The law does provide, I must say to you, that they look at these synergies in any case. I don't know if they ever reflect it. And I think that nothing prevents you from sending that information.
By other board members, and then the last remaining question regarding career housing. We have within available resources.
I don't think it's on that.
Sorry. We have within available resources tried to address this, but it's a problem. I think one thing that we've recognized and we've discussed this, and the CEO knows my views on this, and she's looking at it, is to say the problem that we have internally is that our lawyers who want to practice law find themselves in a position where for them to earn more, where they've been lawyers for a long time, for them to be paid higher, they've got to go into management in the legal report, and we only have a limited number of management positions. So we're looking at the way of career pathing to sort of not to penalize those who want to remain specialists. We're looking at that, but that's also determined by the available funds.
But I think what you need to do is, see the strategic plan is very overarching, very clear, and which is what a strategic plan should be. What I'm saying is, what you need to do is, you need to structure something. You need to put in place a design, an organizational design, that allows for some kind of career passing along the way. So that if somebody wants to be as you say, you start off at a certain base over a period of 5 years, you either have an office or you put in that plan right up to 20-25 years later, and that you will be eligible for commission to high court. So that you have a sense of what you would like to see. And only then will you actually be able to start consulting on it, start motivating for additional funds. We'd like to see that. We'd like to see that feature. Because of us, you know, that the process of what's happening now, unfortunately, is before people want to retain their staff, you then add funds to the institution. The inclination is to then start designing, I suppose, at a higher salary level. People basically remaining in their jobs and as a result of this function. Instead of having a proper systematic program and career planning within your organization. Because what that has led to, for example, in the NPA, is that about 80% of the vacancies that they filled in the last year is actually internal. And so we're getting no new bodies. There's nobody new coming into the organization, although they can say that they've sold X amount of vacancies. And so that really is a problem, because it's not sustainable, is what I'm saying to you. You can do it once, do it twice, but you're not going to be able to do it again. And so very important. actually then show, as far as human capital is concerned, the first decision in terms of improving the quality of service and so on, to have this particular design in mind and the strategy that you wish to implement. And then you've got, and then over the next MPS period, you motivate them. And then hopefully in 5-10 years' time, you actually have a fully functioning process of career advancement, which will then stand you. Okay, lovely. Thank you very much. Mr. Budavanka, do you want to proceed? I know we've covered some of the areas in your presentation, so you're very welcome to go through it all over again. We'll have a discussion again. Don't tire yourself. Do you want to put it up there, or do you want to? Shall I take that away? Okay. Well, please feel free. I've asked that the aircon not be put on because the problem is that it creates such a noise up here. And secondly, I'm highly allergic to and start anything in between your
I'm just finding the presentation in the notebook.
Send on my screen, input signal out the brain. Do you think you can... Is it something on your screen?
I'm using the same computer now.
Morning to the committee also again, and thank you for the opportunity to see what we're doing with you. What what this talk focuses on is the performance over the two financial years, because since the last annual report, which is the 2005-2006 one, was given, I don't think we reached the committee, and it also, since we just completed a second financial year, it also includes that, although that annual report is still to be finalized and submitted. So the main focus of it is obviously legal services delivery. We have a bit more information for you this year than we did previously. From our system, we are able to gather that and we want to share that with you. And then, as usual, we will also report on finances, human resources, and other issues. As far as the performance is concerned, what we do is we set it out in a way where we spell out the 2005-2006 strategic priorities and then going on to the 2006-2007. So you can see the comparison between the two years. When I talk, I'll report on 2006-2007 since that's the most up-to-date. But for reference purposes, if you have any questions, then you can ask year on year how we've done. As far as the strategic priorities are concerned, it checks the implementation priorities arising from our strategic plan. As you know, each year the strategic plan is reviewed, and that informs the preparation of our business plan, which we then use to implement our program. So the strategic priorities for legal services delivery, I think, are what we have had, and that is in keeping with our mandate, which is to increase access to legal aid services. So access is an important area. Quality is obviously the second important area. And then, as we've now consolidated our organization, we want to look at how, and we have started looking at a client-centered approach, which is then giving, putting our clients at the center of delivery. Rather than getting things right, we can now focus on delivery and put clients at the center of it, as well as look at stakeholder relationships and improving those, working with stakeholders within and outside the justice cluster, and increasing the profile of the legal aid board, contributing to building an efficient justice system, because we are an integral part of it, and the better we work, the more it would also make the justice system work. And lastly, improving citizens' awareness of the legal services that we offer, but also of the human rights and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, so that improve people living by the rule of law and also themselves understanding and defending and protecting the rights that we have there. So in keeping with those priorities, the performance as far as legal services delivery is concerned is that in this financial year, as with the past year, legal services were available at all courts, so at all criminal courts. So we have coverage. The issue is now one of the ratio of practitioners per court. The number of legal matters that we did this year increased, and that was from 340,000 to 387,000 new matters. And this includes matters done by our justice centers, by our judicare practitioners, and by our cooperation partners. The reason we had that 14% increase is because we had an increase in capacity related to additional funds received in the year. So that reflects directly on that. The client focus continued, and what we are now doing is looking at proactively addressing the needs of specific groups. And this past financial year, we did that with children. Whereas in the past, and we continue to provide a general service to all clients, we believe that if we identify vulnerable groups and provide a greater focus to these groups, then that will improve their access to these services. And in this past year, the focus was children, so we set up children's units at our bigger justice centers and increased capacity, which also will mean then increasing our legal practitioners' ability to do matters related to children, and as per the Constitution, both, in this case, both criminal and civil matters. Client relationship management programs were reviewed to ensure effectiveness. Again, if the client is at the center of our delivery, then we need to ensure that we are responsive to client needs, and in that way, looking at that. Quality assurance and interventions and monitoring, again, continues. Focus on better prepared legal practitioners, so again, making and ensuring that our practitioners don't only spend every day in court, but spend time preparing and researching for their cases. It's still not adequate, but we are making sure that they do more of that. That will obviously impact directly on quality. And that links to that and links to the issue of improving quality is that we now have which is now for the first time in the last financial year has caught observation in the sense that we have supervisory professional assistants who actually monitor the coursework and the case files for practitioners, and that obviously will also improve on quality. That is not only a monitoring intervention, but it is also a developmental and support intervention in that they then they are then mentoring and coaching these practitioners as they go. Court stakeholder quality feedback on performance. So we also getting feedback on an ongoing basis. We did request in a structured form feedback, and some of it we did get, some of it we get on an ongoing basis. And what we're finding is at a local level, we're encouraging all our justice center heads to engage in the court committees that are convened in the, wherever they are, high courts, they're convened by the JP, in other instances by the magistrate, and to participate in these case flow forums as well as any stakeholder forums that are initiated to improve the functioning of court and of the justice system. Legal training obviously will also impact on quality, and we're continuing to do that. And as we have a better understanding of the types of methods that our practitioners deal with, then we focus on enhancing those skills that are needed for that. And we also have from time to time undertaken independent audits of our quality, which then allows us to, other than what our own supervisory staff do, get an external person to come and assess whether the quality of our legal practitioners is at the levels that we think they are, and what are the types of interventions and things that will help them improve, and we then spend time implementing those recommendations. Okay, so moving on in terms of the legal services delivery, the criminal court coverage was maintained on a national basis. In terms of impact services litigation, we also continued with that. Impact services is where we take up cases that affect large groups of people, or where there's precedent setting legislation that has to be looked at, etc. And in those matters, we also give assistance to indigent persons. Stakeholder forums were convened in all provinces as well as in regions, and we, on an ongoing basis, engage with stakeholders. We also know, and some of you attended our national conference on access to justice, which we believe was quite successful and was well attended. And we increased representation on the national and provincial steering committees of the justice cluster so that we can again feed into greater efficiency. In this area in particular, that we also feel that we've made good progress in this year, where other stakeholders also are involving us in it, and we ourselves, as we are participating in this, getting more and more involved in these forums, and I think that contributes to an improved functioning of the justice system. The public education campaigns were maintained, and in that we have various levels of activities which are listed here and in our annual report, and also the Legal Aid Board as a brand and as a provider of legal services to poor people, as a point at which one can improve access to justice is promoted, and that is confirmed through surveys that we do in terms of how that is improving or not. And we think that more and more people are turning to us, and even independent research that's done by other NGOs, university-based clinics, at a very local level, and that's primary research I'm talking about, where they actually go and interview households, it's encouraging to note that people do turn to the Legal Aid Board when they need assistance. So that's our core program, and will continue to be our core program, which is the delivery of legal services. Related to that is the program which is about building an efficient justice system, and in that we participated in various justice cluster initiatives. We talked about some of these. We also made submissions on the white paper process other than the legal services charter, which white paper process is intended to incorporate more than what, although it was called white paper on transformation of the judiciary, it was intended to incorporate more than that. So we were hoping that they would devote a chapter on legal aid, because as you know, the Legal Aid Act is very old, 1969-1970, and needs to be, that doesn't need amendment, it was amended, but it needs to be rewritten. And as a precursor to that, we would need this process in engaging with the department on that. And hopefully we will make some progress. Other than that, we participate in the criminal justice review teams and the case backlog teams. Again, but and as you can see here, that we do note a it might sound like a bit like a stuck record, but the reality is that monies are allocated to the DOJ and the NPA and haven't been transferred to us, and that is of concern because this is an additional special focus program which require additional money, and we believe that those must be taken into our fund. So just to share information which is in a more tabled and in a more graphic form, Justice Centers, the Justice Centers we have, we also have 48 Justice Centers. We increased the number of satellite offices in over these 2 years to 41, and we still have High Court units wherever we have High Courts. As far as staff is concerned, the number of staff we have, the budgeted posts are 2,000 plus, and the number that we have recruited is 1,953. Of those, 76% of our staff are legal professionals. So that is important, and they are available across the. So if you add the 41 satellites as well as the 58 justice centers, we now have a presence at about 99 sites across the country. And we think that that obviously helps improve access to justice. The total number of matters year on year is indicated there from 340,000 to 387,000. In terms of justice centers, the numbers that they just increased from 291,000 to 342. In court and Judy came at 42,000 to 39. This is not really a decrease in Judy K in terms of a intended decrease, but as we have funds available which are available because all our staff may not be recruited, those are devoted to Judy K. So that's why that number would vary across the years. And then our involvement with cooperation partners who are also funded continues and that's so this shows both an increase in terms of the number of matters over the 3 years, the past 3 years, as well as in terms of the types, the delivery system that we use. And this is another graphic representation of the same. Next delivery system, just in terms of how it compares in a total form, again another graphic representation. Yes, the civil and criminal steps, in terms of the number of civil matters we've done, from 2005 to 2006, in fact, we haven't increased them because of the fact that we don't have enough capacity to do so. So we are still sitting at around 40,000 civil matters, including both the matters done by us as well as the cooperation partners. The number of finalized matters, again, there's kept shade on that in terms of the new matters, that is, matters we take on compared to that. So if you recall, in 2006-2007, we said we did 380,000 odd, and here we've got about 363,000 instead of finalized. So we can keep track on that, upload, and make sure that we do. This is just a spread of the matters across the provinces over the 2 years, and the geographic representation, which shows that obviously the bigger provinces of Gauteng, Western Cape, and KZN, and KwaZulu-Natal have the larger numbers of matters, and then accordingly the other provinces. It also shows, the blue ones show the ones that are done by our justice center, the red indicates the ones done by Judy K practitioners, and the yellow shows cooperation partners, which shows that in fact we don't have cooperation partners in all provinces. We do invite cooperation partners to a public process. We advertise in the newspaper annually, and we ask them to make submissions. But it must be for legal services delivery. So it must improve legal services delivery. It's not for advice, it's not for any of those other methods. General things. So that is why, in the end, the number of partners that are actually delivering legal services are not that many in the country. So that's the listing of the partners over the 2 years. And then some of the stats that Brian referred to earlier, and that is a summary of the analysis of the charges. And you can see here that, and this is in terms of the count of the charges. It's not the same as the number of matters that we talked about earlier. And in that case, the ones that we counted in terms of 271,000 charges that we listed, of those, 61% are withdrawn. And that's quite a high number. And also, if you see it in the pie chart, you can see that the bulk of them are actually withdrawn. And that from them, but the reason we were also interested in these steps is that for the sake of our own practitioners, we need to see how are we, excuse me, faring in terms of whether or not all the persons that are represented by the legal aid board convicted or whether they have a chance, and to dispel the myth that all clients represented by legal aid are actually convicted. This reflects it, that in fact we have acquittals, we have convictions on lesser charges and convictions on the main charge, but that a large number are withdrawn. We would say that also a strong public defender system is important in terms of that category of withdrawals, because if there isn't a good enough or strong enough case, then the prosecution can still pursue it if there isn't an adequate representation from a public defender. But when there is, then that balances it, and that is part of the system of justice. And then moving on, if we exclude the withdrawals, then if we look at acquittals and convictions on lesser charges and main charges, then we see that in fact, excluding withdrawals, 23% acquittals, which we believe is not fair. The reason we say that is because obviously the prosecution determines which matters go to court. Out of the number of arrests that are made by theft, as I said, there's about 2 million plus going, arrested. Of that, they determine how many of those charges can be brought, and of those, how many can be taken to court. So that's already a system of process. It's only those that they believe there is a case that can be taken forward, and so this reflects on how our interventions are making a difference. Then, in terms of our involvement in making an efficient justice system work, we listed the types of reasons that are given for postponement from our perspective, in the sense that when we've recorded them, from whether it's from case files, from our practitioners, or whatever, and in terms of the number of matters, you can see the varied number, and often, and one of the reasons is also for us to look at how and what interventions we as a legal aid board can make in instances where we are responsible for postponements or for delays. And we found that about 4.5% of the matters are attributed to legal aid board. And as a direct result of our link in terms of this performance, as well as steps done by the NPA, and I think NPA steps, some of the steps that might have been shared with you, showed that for about, I think, was it 7 or 11%, that the legal aid board was responsible for postponement. We looked at that, and primarily the reasons given were in the court of first appearance that there wasn't a legal practitioner available. And what we found is that it's easy to say there isn't an LAB lawyer there, but actually it's rarely that a case can proceed, because it's the first appearance, they actually just present the charges and then it gets set down for a hearing. But in addition, and despite that, what we did is we said that what we needed to do is respond to that and ensure that we have sufficient representation at those courts so that we can, nobody left without a person who can represent them. And we've increased them, wherever there are channelization courts and courts of first appearance, we've increased the number of persons there to number of practitioners there to 2 practitioners. So that always, even if one is busy with one client, somebody else is available to then take on another client. No one is forced. It's when the client doesn't have, or the accused doesn't have a lawyer, then the magistrate or the judge would advise them for the need for a lawyer, and it's up to them to determine whether they can afford a price or then legal aid is available. So those are the ways in which we have used our steps to understand where our own gaps are and see how we can plug them on an ongoing basis to improve our ability to deliver. Then what we also have in terms of our matters is to try and understand what are the types of matters that we're dealing with. These are only criminal matters. And in criminal matters, you can see that 45% of the matters we're dealing with are aggressive. These categories we've used, we try to keep the same as with the others in the justice sector, which is the NPA and other steps, so that we can compare. And aggressive would include then, it would include theft, robbery and murder, and those types. Economic would include theft, etc., and all the rest. So the bulk are actually in the first 2 categories, aggressive matters and economic matters. And that's where a lot of the criminal work that we're doing is. In terms of the types of civil matters, this lists the type of civil matters that we're doing. We have a large category called other, which is civil, the second line from the top, and that looks like a lot. But there's a lot of small types of matters which get added into a whole range of types of methods which couldn't be listed otherwise with brilliant or over several pages. And so in that sense, that is why that is a large number. But you can see that this is the range of types of methods that come to us. And in terms of, again, a pie chart, that's the spread. This is the types of methods that we are doing in civil work. So that's legal services delivery and some of our data, and I think that I'm sure members will pick up on that. As far as finance is concerned, moving on to that, what were our priorities for this year's strategic priorities? It was obviously to maintain the unqualified audit report we had, and we wanted to move on, and as with 05-06, we actually achieved, for the first time, a report from the Auditor General which didn't have any matters that were emphasized. So we thought that was quite an achievement, and we needed to now maintain that. So no qualification and no matters emphasized is what our aim is. Then we wanted to ensure that the money that we have, because of the fact that we always say we need more money, we have to ensure and demonstrate that that money reaches the client. So we want to ensure that our expenditure is within 99% of the budget. And that is in line with the budget, not just when we have money we use it for whatever. And it's in line with ensuring that the bulk of it goes to legal services delivery. So even when we have savings in because our largest because the bulk of the services we provide is through our own lawyers, our biggest line item on our budget is salaries for our legal professionals and other staff. That if we have savings in that line item, whenever that is there, we try and move it to duty care, which means that we then outsource it. So if we don't have enough lawyers internally recruited at any point in time and savings as a result of that, then those are then that's done through duty care. And that way we ensure that legal services are getting clients as required. And then sound fixed asset management. In previous years, you may recall that one of the areas which weren't emphasized, in fact, and which were of concern was fixed assets, and that was sorted out. And so in this financial year, we had to ensure that we maintain that, and then to look at in terms of our supply chain management policy to include the BEE monitoring and the codes that have been produced by the government. And then sound creditor management is obviously where we have duty care practitioners and other creditors to ensure that they get paid timely so that they can continue to provide the services that we need. In that regard, and in terms of performance, then we maintain our audit status as explained. For 2006-2007, we are currently in the process of finalizing our annual financial statements, which will be submitted to the Auditor General by the end of May as per requirements, and that they will audit it, and we will then have a final report to Parliament by September. Our expenditure is within the 99% budget that we talked about, and our fixed assets have been reconciled through the year, and we're happy to say that we maintain that. We also now proactively have a capital replacement program, which is a more improved management of our fixed assets and the replacement of it. If you recall that in the past few years, we set up Justice Centers almost from scratch, so we went from in about 2000, in the year 2000, having very few Justice Centers, which were previously law clinics linked to universities or whatever. We went from a few of those to 58 plus satellite offices, that we then increased the numbers of staff from about 300 to now 1,500 to 2,000. With all of that, we then had to set up offices, have fixed assets. And now we need to look at what is the replacement program for that. And for different types of fixed assets, we would have a different period. So this is more actively managing that and budgeting for it. Supply chain management is the same as I talked about earlier. Again, setting up a preferred supply database, also for those that we don't have to go out and tender, but using people on their database in keeping with the BGE policies, and their creditors have been managed successfully, and we haven't had any deadlocks. In terms of the MTEF allocations, these were the allocations that we received over the different years, and it reflects the increases in many of these. It was largely the cost of living increase in the last 2 years. We had in the 2006-2007 year, that is, we had 35 million in addition to the cost of living increase to our baseline, and of that 10 million rand was for children, which is what we used to set up the children's PAs across the country. And in the 2007-2008 year, which is the year we just started, we received an increase, an additional 50 million for additional new programs. So what did we use the 50 million for? This is a reflection of that, and in terms of the big amount, the one of the main things we did is increasing of the ratio of PAs at regional courts. And I think that in your slide, in the version that circulated, one of these, either one or two, has been, is not correct. I think it's either regional reception, and I'll put it as reception. So this is just to use this that is up on the screen as the correct version, increased ratio of PAs at regional courts. This is where we're taking it up to 1.25 PAs per regional court. Then strengthening of PAs at reception courts, this is the point I made earlier about improving and having at least two people at every reception court so that we don't have any people slipping through the cracks. Increasing the number of satellite offices. Senior litigation capacity, again, this refers to the discussion that was being held earlier, that in addition to having our PAs, we are setting up this category of senior litigators, which would be at the same level as our managers. So people don't have to progress to be managers if you want to stay lawyers. And often you would find that in big cases, whether it's prosecution or defense, they're bringing in people from outside. So how do we match the senior counsel that's been put up by prosecution in some of the big matters we're dealing with, matters where we got around poker, etc., and we're dealing with some of those at the moment. And in those cases, we then have to look at this, but in addition, we will supplement it where necessary, but still within our legal aid board tariff. So that's the type of expenditure, and that's what we've used the money for. In terms of our budget over the various years, this is an indication of the NTEF allocations each year, and then the way in which the budget was set up, and what you can see is that we provide for depreciation and interest, and then we get to the budget. In the 1 year, 2005-2006, the provision for the rollover, or the provision, which is 78 million in 2005-2006 and 2006-2007, was 90 million. So I may just explain that so that it doesn't look like we have unspent funds that are rolled over. What this relates to is that where we have given out instructions on duty care, which is to outside lawyers, we have then a contractual commitment for them to provide the service. Depending on the nature of the matter and the time that it takes in the court, that matter may or may not be complete by the year end. But because we have a contractual commitment to them, that means that we have to provide for it on our books, so that if that account comes to us, and it will come to us in many instances, that when that, should I say again, not rather, if when that account comes to us, we have the money to pay for it. So we can't just give it and then forget. So this is the only instance in which we then have to provide for it, and that you will see in our financial statements also. That is, these are clearly contractual commitments with lawyers. And these are some notes explaining a bit more. I won't go into the details. The budget versus expenditure, both for 2005-2006, links to that issue of spending within that budget that we have. Again, as you see below this total, that shows commitments to duty care and commitments to legal aid house. Again, that duty care relates to the same issue. So that even though it might be that we have certain cash, it's actually that we have to provide for that commitment on our financials. In terms of audit matters, I've covered this in terms of unqualified audits, and I'll then move on to human resources. As far as human resources is concerned, again, we are in the business of delivering legal services, professional legal services, which means that our core asset is our people, our lawyers who deliver the services. If we didn't have them, we wouldn't be able to do what we're supposed to do and fulfill our mandate. In that context, that our people development strategy is critical. Human capital development, as well as employee wellness and people development, are all at the core of this human resources strategy. And in that, we look at various things. In addition to the mandatory and statutory requirements of employment equity, skills development, etc., we ourselves are looking at issues of diversity management, leadership development, knowledge management, succession planning, etc. In terms of the achievements, we have our legal training programs are now working well and focusing on the skills and competencies we require to deliver the particular legal services that we are responsible for. Our employment equity programs and targets are in place, and we are on track to achieving those. Our HIV AIDS strategies are also there, and so is our employee wellness program. Organizational culture is an important part of this program, because we believe that if our employees believe in the Legal Aid Board, then they will be the best ambassadors of the Legal Aid Board, and that is why the culture that we have, a culture which is aligned to deliver our vision and to live by the values of the Legal Aid Board, is important, and we devote energy to ensuring that we have a cohesive culture across the organization. We have a large turnover in terms of the CAs that we have, so we employ between 500 and 600 CAs, and obviously that impacts, because they're only with us for less than 2 years, and in that case, then it's on an ongoing basis, it affects both our training but also our culture. One of the issues on quality, and many stakeholders are raising it, and even the law societies and others are raising it, is that whereas we provide we are probably the biggest provider of access to the profession in terms of employing CAs, one of the concerns is whether the CAs are adequately prepared to represent clients. Now, I must clarify that CAs only represent clients in this report. So it's only in the minor matters, and where necessary, we will then put in CAs. What we believe is in terms of its impact on our quality, and again, as I explained, the high turnover, even where we are training CAs and we do spend devote energy training our CAs, it is for the good of the country and profession as a whole, because many of them leave us. But those that do stay, and the new ones that we get on an ongoing basis, they impact on our quality. So the issue is that, what do we do about it? And we believe that we shouldn't carry on growing that part of our capital, of our human capital section, in the sense that we shouldn't increase the number of CAs. We're not decreasing them, but if we have more posts, we're trying to increase them by number of CAs, which we believe will impact positively on our overall ability to deliver services. Succession planning, diversity management, competency-based leadership, all programs that are underway and on track. Knowledge management will allow us to document and to put in place systems whereby the knowledge that is generated through the various matters that we ourselves handle is shared across the country with our lawyers, and that we then make use of that in a more structured way. And then performance management is an important part of our ability to deliver. Our performance management system is aligned to our business plan. Every single person in the Legal Aid Board has a performance contract on an annual basis, and they are reviewed at mid-year and at the year end, and on that basis they are scored in terms of whether or not they've performed. Moving on then to the last section and the rest of the support that goes into making the Legal Aid Board function, governance is again an important part, given the Legal Aid Board of 1999-2000. Our board is functioning effectively. As you see, we have a large delegation from our board with us today, and we had one of our board members was appointed to the bench, and therefore we have a new member. But board member training and evaluation, self-evaluation, etc., is continuing, and they continue to provide good strategic direction to us and leadership. As far as risk is concerned, we have in place all the instruments to manage our risk. We have our risk management plans, fraud management plans, etc., and then the implementation of those is tracked. Our audit committee is very functional and vocal, and they keep track of us in terms of whether or not we are performing in relation to these instruments that we have. And so strategic and operational risks are identified, and we look at mitigating controls to manage these. The business continuity plans ensure that when there are any disruptions to our business in whatever way, that it is possible for us to continue to function. In that regard, an example was one of our justice centers in Middleburg burned down because the shopping center in which it was burned. And we lost a lot of our things, but we were operational within days, and we were able to get back to normality fairly soon because of these backup arrangements. the risk assurance is also there in terms of our audit coverage plans. We have a strong internal audit department, which audits has an audit coverage plan and is linked to the risk, and then it may ensure that there is a monitoring of compliance and increasingly a monitoring of performance, so that we can then assess how we're doing in terms of managing these risks. And we've now increased that include capacity for computer audits. Our IT disaster recovery works well. We actually do test runs every day, as required every year, and those have worked well. So moving on to IT, previously we talked to you about a new system. We had the ad infinitum system that was installed about in 2004, and that's now settled, and that is able to give us the type of data I shared with you earlier. So we're very satisfied with it. It has worked well and stable, and we are now using it for you. We also have training modules for people to be trained in terms of computer literacy and improved use of those systems. And this year, we also introduced a new SAP staff module for the human resources section. And in terms of that, we will look at if there are any other additions we can make separately from the ongoing enhancements to the ad infinitum system. And the ad infinitum system, by the way, focuses on legal administration and finance. So legal administration was covered, finance is covered, so now we've done HR, and then we can wrap up on any of the outstanding parts of the legal report. So what are the challenges? And I don't think you have this slide, so I've just added it on because when we delivered this, we didn't have this. Is that ongoing challenge of continuing to improve access beyond the court systems. In terms of our criminal court system, you know that we said we have coverage at every court, and an increasing presence in courtrooms, increasing ratio of practitioners per court, but beyond the court system, and the court systems are not aligned to service some parts of our country, in particular township areas as well as the rural areas. However, you must also note that in the rural areas, that assistance should be largely civil in nature. That in rural areas, that type of assistance outside of the court system would be civil in nature. Then continuous improvement of quality of legal services, which is our core business. And then the ratio of practitioners per court continues to be out of sync with other justice states. Stakeholders, as we mentioned, and then the remuneration of legal practitioners is also out of sync. In terms of then, to sum up, what do we believe in terms of our performance? How are we doing? And we believe that we have consolidated on our work, as has been mentioned by our chairperson, that we have improved access to justice by poor South Africans, improved access to justice by poor South Africans continues as our capacity increases, so that's the 387,000 members. And in that, specifically, we mean that the number of courtrooms we service has increased, the number of clients we've assisted has increased, the type of legal matters taken up has increased, where we have an increased focus on special matters, and then public education is ongoing. Secondly, we have an improved quality of legal services delivered as quality programs are consolidated. So whereas we keep it as a challenge also because we believe as our core business, whatever our quality is, we must continue to still try to improve it. We believe we are doing better than we were doing a few years ago. Increased participation in justice cluster initiatives is also now improved. And then strong governance and financial management and strong support platform continues. So overall, we're happy to report that we are spending the funds that we are receiving to reach as many people as we can in terms of delivering legal services to people. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lots of issues, members. I'm going to take the Johnson sector,
have more, then it's fine, because I don't want to then have a third round.
Okay, thank you. I just want to find out how do you train your CA. If you have a particular maybe syllabus, what areas can cover and then secondly, in the past, there were a lot of outcry about delays in settling a practitioner's fee has been overcome. Thank you, Chair. My question is on the means test. If I read it right, it is not a requirement of the Constitution itself. The Constitution only states that if substantial injustice is otherwise the result. But I know we do apply the means test, but my problem with the means test is that it puts most people applicable. For example, our colleagues who had the problem with the travel date, there was an article in Sunday Times by Chris Barron, where it was said that they pleaded guilty not because they felt they were guilty, but they couldn't afford to defend their case, which is a really nice thing. So I think we must have a look at this.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just two issues. Just a more sort of generic, general question. This one on candidate attorneys. We've been reading quite a lot recently about how the members of the profession are saying that candidate attorneys and graduates are entering the system and they can't propose proper affidavits and they can't write proper letters. Just whether this is your experience as well, because I think there should be some debate about how we structure the law degrees at our universities and the syllabus. And then the second point is just if you could give us an indication of maybe the workload of PAs, how many active cases your PAs are carrying on a day-to-day basis. Thanks.
I think those last two questions are quite important because they point to a need for us in this committee to understand the extent of the workload first with its candidate. And I imagine that the enormous disparity is going to be like the current urban and rural locations as well. So it would be very important for us to have a look at that, particularly in light of the fact that we're talking about resources. As far as your candidate attorneys are concerned, let me add one more question there. You know, with the prosecution authority, they do like a training here, prior. And I know that those candidate attorneys that may not need salary work out too well. But what worries me more, and the bigger question is around the quality, the issues that you raised when you started both in your strategic plan and your the presentation that we've just heard now. If I were to, from where I sit, try and assess what is the quality of work emanating from particularly the legal system, the fact that what would be the factors that I would consider would be set? Would it be your acquittal rate? Would it be your feedback that you get from your client evaluation system that you have there? Would it be the average years of experience of your average person in your regional force, your district force, your district, your fish? Would it be your average qualification of your conditions and skills, that kind of thing? I'd like you to talk to me a little bit about that, so that where we're sitting from, as you know, one of the biggest sources of complaints that I get in my office. People who have been convicted, lost their appeals, some of which I've sent over to your offices for response as well. But the perception then is created partly from the legal profession and partly from the confusion of clients that the quality of service is important to them. And there needs to be some kind of objective standardization. applied to determine how that can be fixed. And I'd like to hear your views on that matter first. And let's just take that round of questions. We'll then enter into further discussions with members and what you want to say as well. We still have some time to do that. But I want to give you as much time as possible to just respond to these questions. And then if need be, we'll go a little bit into lunch and then finalize our discussion rather than a journey to lunch. But over to you.
Did you say you wanted to start with the fees?
No, you can start. We'll have a further discussion because depending on what your answers are, I think we need to then input with you, particularly on that issue.
Okay, the one set of questions which relate to fees, the training, etc., and quality, I'll deal with that second. So let me just deal with the other methods. Firstly, the means test. Yeah, then the means test is, the Constitution provides that, as you rightly say, where there's substantial injustice, then the state needs to provide legal assistance. And we then have to quantify that and clarify, say, what does it mean, and where do we have a cutoff, basically. And we've been using the means test, and the question was, well, if we were challenged, would that withstand a challenge? And so, in looking at it, firstly, we look at two things. One is just the income, and the second is then the ability of the person to afford the cost of the entire case. So it's not only then income, which is why in the bigger matters, even though people might have earned more than what our cutoff point is, we do give assistance. Because if the trial is going to run over a year, 2 years, etc., then if we take into account their income, they're never going to be able to afford it. So in that case, we do. In certain instances, we've also had a situation where we say we can provide partial assistance because people can't afford the cost of the full trial, but they can contribute towards it. And we, in fact, are working on a system, and we haven't finalized it yet, which will then be put into our legal aid guide, and in fact will have to come to Parliament for you to look at, is to say, how do we get people who earn above the means test but may not afford the cost of a long trial, how do we accommodate those people? And in those cases, they can make some contribution. Obviously, there are a lot of administrative issues around that, where how we make it work, what happens if they don't pay, etc., etc. Just to say that in one instance in PE, we did have a situation where we refused legal aid for one of these big types of matters. The court ordered us and said we should look at it, and in fact, then spelled out the terms by which that the persons who were actually being tried had to then make a contribution. So the judge himself did, and he said instead of court intervening to say on what terms that should happen, we should actually spell out a clearer system so that it is, in our case, the main thing is that it must be uniform across the country and it must be sustainable. So we don't want it to be unsustainable. So coming back again, the question of whether, in fact, we would then be able to withstand a challenge to this is that we then got an opinion from Edward Trengrove, and he clarified for us and unpacked those matters for us in terms of substantial injustice, and said that we would be able to have limits in terms of means, and secondly that we would have to look at the issue of whether the cost of the matter could be borne. So we do have that, and if anyone's interested in that opinion, we can make it available. But I think that clarifies and that responds to that issue. We also try and...
There's also the factor of the importance of the availability of resources.
Yes,
you have to.
Correct. Which is why we have to have that a cutoff. And then the question is, but then where should that cutoff be? And so we also then try to see if we could link it to a subsistence level. And as you know, across the country, there's different types of subsistence levels that have been generated by different universities, etc. So it isn't clear, but we also need to keep sort of increasing that on an annual basis, because obviously we would have a situation whereby we are well below that, because each year as inflation increases, then we have a situation where more and more people can't afford. Having said all of that, I would also say that there is a category of people which falls between those that we assist and those that can afford their own legal services, and we call that category the almost poor. And that category actually doesn't get legal services, and that is a gap. So it's in that instance that what we need to do is look at it, creative ways in which one can respond to their needs. And that will be true for any subsidy system, actually, that the government's involved in. And I know for a fact that we had the same issue when we were dealing with housing subsidies, that we have the different housing subsidies for different incomes, but then we have that category, the in-between category. And there what we are doing at the moment is looking at proposals of how, whether there is a role for the state in that, but also whether the legal profession can play a role, because the legal profession has constantly being unhappy about the fact that more and more work gets taken from them. But what are they doing about that category? Because the more they can reach people, the less we will have to do it. And so that's something that is an area that, in fact, is in our business plan that we've got to do more work. So that is one into that issue. In terms of a lot of the other issues relate to the CAs and the quality, and I'm going to ask Brian to respond to that because he can go through some of the actual measures and interventions that we have both to improve quality and to monitor, and then go on to answer the questions of the workload, that means the number of methods per practitioner, and how do we set that as a target, and how do we manage that, in which instances we choose it. Okay. And how we do it. And the last one that the chairperson just reminded me is whether we have any delays in setting of practitioners accounts. In the month, I'm very happy to say in this financial year we have had no such delays. And in fact, I receive those figures on a daily basis and we track it to ensure that we are within the 30 days. In the few instances where we do go over, that is because of the fact that we're waiting for information, etc. So we don't have any such delays at the moment. But Brian, do you want to pick up on the quality?
Chairperson, I will start off by talking about Kevin's terms because I think there are quite a few committee members who focused on it. Just to indicate that approximately 60% of our work is done by Kevin's terms because that's the volume of work that is done in our district courts. So actually give this particular category of staff very serious specific focus. So when we recruit a candidate attorney, we either recruit a cabinet attorney that has only been through his practical legal training, or it could be a cabinet attorney that comes fresh from law school. And based on that, the period of contract is dictated. It's 1 year if it's a PLC, when they went to practical school, or 2 years otherwise. No cabinet attorney is allowed to go to court till they go through a rigorous 6 week pre-court readiness checklist. So what we have done is, through a consultative process, look at all the things that a cabinet attorney needs to know and be familiar with and knowledgeable and at the same time confident in before they actually go to court. And we have set a minimum time of 6 weeks, but it could be extended depending on it. And it's only when a manager, in this case it will be a principal attorney and just principal, has completed that and said that this cabinet attorney has completed 100% of the work, will he then be allowed to go court. And in deploying people to court, managers rotate cabinet attorneys on a 6 monthly basis. So the newer cabinet attorneys are sent to court, so-called the reception court, before they move to more the time court. So your court readiness checklist plays that role, and we have got various extensive programs that are already developed that they'll have to go through to ensure it's done. Then what we also see here is we have got an obligation to ensure that this cabinet attorney is ready for admission to the profession, because we acknowledge that much of the work they do in court may only consume a portion of the readiness as an attorney to be admitted. So we have undertaken a study of the curriculum for the attorney to be admitted, and we have developed what we call is a pre-admittance checklist. So basically it's a syllabus of all the work that a cabinet attorney needs to be exposed to practically and also actively, so that the principal attorney, when it comes to family needs private person with certain problems to be admitted. He feels comfortable with it. And that takes between 1 and 2 years. And it's monitored on a monthly basis. And at the end of the month, every month, the manager has to indicate what percentage of the checklist has been completed. The rigorously followed. And the reason we are careful about it is because all these guys are registered with the Law Society. We engage with them on a quarterly basis. And they are very particular about the quality of the work done by our candidates. And then you find that even in civil work, we must expose them to a certain element of civil work. So much of that 35,000 would have been done through our candidates. We believe the strength of our training program, and this is advanced by, and it's, you know, it's becoming quite common with people, the candidates themselves, especially the approaching that is taking place of our health training is indicative of the fact that the quality of the training they're exposed to is better than most people anticipate. It's because of our great support and developmental progress. And the CEO mentioned our supervisory capacity. And in 1 month, and basically we have got like a supervisor per 3.5 CAs in a justice center. And these supervisory capacity don't have a court load that would be applicable in the private sector profession. So the total job is quality management. So you find that every day, without fail, files of a camera 10, and to also our professional staff, is monitored the proactively as well as like a post-mortem, because on a daily basis, or in some cases weekly, we have what we call a case discussion forum, whereby a team of about 7 PAs and CAs together with the supervisor needs to discuss what are your cases for the next day or the week. And then what we engage in a proactive discussion on legal strategy. It also indicates to us whether this person is prepared for the case or not. So that's how we actually ensure that reading and preparation is taking place and that no client is actually only consulted with on the day of the trial, because that will be a serious disciplinary issue now with the legal report, because we want that to be done before that. So our supervisory capacity ensures that there's continuous monitoring case support. Then we've got various monitoring mechanisms, and this comes with what is the factors of quality. In fact, it's something that we have been debating over time, and I think it will be an ongoing debate and discussion. But what we have done is that we want to rate our practitioners' quality. So we have developed, over time, refined various quality assurance instruments that looks at both the file management aspect of it, from the level of consultation, the pre-trial, the actual presenting of the case, the ethics and administration of the case. And we looked at the component parts and we said, what are the quality standards that should be applicable? And what we found is, and this was also independently verified when we got in some auditors to actually look at who were legal people also, is that one can gauge very much from a file the level of performance or preparation that has went to the particular case. But over and above that, to supplement it, we have developed a court observation process whereby supervisors will go to court and observe the cameras throughout the day, and again, a scoring mechanism is put in place. So what we have at the end of the day is, because we can't use the acquittal rates only, but we monitor what the acquittal rates are. We can't use only how many postponements are taking place, how many withdrawals, but we monitor it, and our business intelligence tools are giving us that information. We also want actively to give you a rating as the candidate who is performing in a court. So the instruments actually allow us. So you've got different things. You've got a self-assessment where the candidate actively and analyzes his performance in every case. The supervisor on a quarterly basis does an overview of files on a random basis and gives an assessment. And then you find that our regional offices play, besides the support and development roles, an auditing role. Well, but they're also going to look at the files and give us a call. And we have now moved to another level where it's independently actually done. And in fact, we just completed a review. Chairperson, we have got various monitoring and monitoring interventions in place to improve quality, including one we're planning for in the later part of this quarter. But we're trying to get together the senior legal minds in the country to look at what is quality from a client perspective. What is quality from a lawyer perspective? what quality should we be rendering as a legal report, as well as sharing what we are doing and then getting an interrogation of that and recommendations for the future. We have done that ongoing and we feel now we are ready for that part. So this is a short comment. It's an integral part of our service delivery program. We like to believe that, and we get this from another judge. We continuously engage with judge. When we deliver legal services at the scale we do, 380,000 members, 340, then if the service is poor, we'll be getting an avalanche of complaints. But the level of complaints that we receive, if I receive one per month, sometimes it's actually not too much. And the ones we receive such a focus, a priority focus to us. So it's we look at the level of monitoring of complaints. We look at the feedback from presiding officers. And I must say that there are presiding officers that do take the time of complimenting the team. And sometimes we share that with our senior management and the board. So that's another factor we look at. We have got an ongoing basis whereby every presiding officer in a court is interviewed on a quarterly basis by supervisors of the team. And the purpose of that is to look at what is the quality of that person in your court, as well as any suggestion for the person to have for the cabinet. And generally what we get as feedback from our region is that presiding officers are generally impressed with the work that we have. But about all the patients have, that they're not afraid to even give you comments. And where this problem areas, they will either. Coming to the workload of our practitioners, and we have actually went through a rigorous process of determining targets. And I think you must have targets because people need to know what is your productivity or what do we expect from you. But targets in itself must be flexible. One needs to understand the nature of the work you're doing. So after an exhaustive process, we came to targets that have been confirmed on two occasions thereafter of candidates tendency engaged in 300 matches per year. Okay? And I think if you look at the withdrawal rate of 65%, then puts that in perspective. Because it's not necessarily carrying cases to court. And district, that's for the district court. The regional court is 200 and the high court is 100. What we find by and large is that our candidates, our practitioners more than achieve the target. We're not saying that the workload is not high, but we feel that the ratio per court is the way to actually assess that particular issue, because the work is being done. With regard to what they can actively at a point in time, when we closed our books in the 2006-07 financial year, we had active file focus of about 156,000. We got about 1,500 lawyers. So roughly each one is carrying about 100 active files at a point in time, which is not unreasonable if you look at what private practitioners will actually tell you at a point in time. I don't know if any other of the regional that maybe want to add to our mind.
I'll give you an opportunity now. I just wanted to double check because as you were speaking, I realized that I got it wrong with the acquittal rate. The acquittal rate is the 9% that you're talking about. It's over the full total of 271 cases, 271,000 cases. So you calculate your acquittal rate on the entire amount, including the withdrawals, those cases that have been withdrawn. That the NPA, what they do is they show us the extent of the cases that have been withdrawn, but they calculate their conviction rate on what actually comes to court. Yeah, so, but I mean, what is it? 23% then, is that for legal? Okay, aspect I think we need to talk about a little more, but let me give you an opportunity. I'm sorry, I forget the name.
Overland. Just to add to aspect, when Brian referred to the candidates and all the training programs, that includes the BA, not only for the candidate attorney. So all those rigorous programs are there for the attorneys as well, except the checklist, which specifically refers to the candidate attorney. But apart from that,
There is another program that we also do, and we do have a client satisfaction feedback form whereby each and every client is encouraged to rate the performance of a lawyer, which we also test on a quarterly basis. Apart from that, you have to keep in mind that in criminal matters, we have said it before, but in criminal matters, the state takes the matter to court where they feel that they've got a prima facie case. So if we are operating on a 23% acquittal rate, we are working from a premise that this was a case that the state took the right to be taken from the matter.
It's interesting to look at what the International
Society
of Companionship in regards to acquittal rates in those countries that have public defenders. That would be a very interesting let me then just, I see lots of hands, but let me just take this issue of quality and then finalize this, and then we'll move on and I'll give other people the opportunity. See, I think, Mr. Mayor, what we're looking at is, and I hear what you say about, because I think you're correct in the approach that you're taking, in that once somebody feels close that door, people are going to start walking in the corridors and making noise and engineering like that. But I think from our perspective, and what I hear from you is that it's very much an individual focus, which is quite correct, because obviously you need to monitor the individual performance of your people. What we're looking at this level, though, is some kind of barometer around the quality of the work of the legal aid board. And so what you need to do is to also define for us what it is that we should be looking at. I would say, for example, one of the things that we need to look at is just like other institutions where you look at things like skills and qualifications of your staff members, because that's obviously a given in your account. What you would want to look at, for example, would be the amount of years of experience, particularly from your regional court level upwards. Are you retaining the people? Are you retaining retaining the people that you've invested in these skills programs and so on that you've mentioned now? Certainly the issue of the acquittal rate will have to be looked at as well, because that's an element, I'm not saying that this is a definitive study, but it's certainly an element. And as I said, the international studies will give us some sense. But also, I think we need that broken down. We need to understand that there's a distinct difference between your district, regional, and high court. You've given us a global picture, but we don't have a sense of what that looks like. And it could be that the candidate attorneys are doing well because they're coming out from the case, but that you're not doing so well at the high court, for example. So we'd like to see that information in the future, and I think that would give us something. And what I'm saying is not necessarily trying to focus on things like equity, because I think that can be very superficial. But I think what I'm saying is we need a whole basket of issues that perhaps you will define for yourself around giving us a barometer at this level overall. And while you certainly need to do what you're doing in terms of your individual candidates and so on, candidates and employers, PAs and so on, I think what we're asking for is something more holistic. I'm just a bit worried because I can't remember offhand. But I know for a fact that when the MPA came to us a few days ago, they give us stats on conviction rates going from February 2006 to January 2007. And they quoted to us something like 89-90% conviction rates in some instances. And again, they break it down. That was at the stage very, very concerning to me. But I understand that there are two factors there that would relate. The one being obviously that you don't do all of them, they probably do all of them. The other one is you don't know the outcomes with regard to your adjudicator matters as opposed to your center matters or the public defender. So would there be a disparity, for example, when you give it over to a jury chair as opposed to him? Because that will give us, I think, a sampling of exactly what it is that we're
So if you can devise those kinds of steps for us and let us have that in the report, that would be very useful. But I'm sure what you can do for us is to do these steps to the full finalization. I'm sure you can get to us in the system so you put the rates and break them down to the court at least, and then if possible the adjudicator versus the public agreement. There was a question over there. I don't know if that's the only something before that. Is that an attempt on policy?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay, let's
This would really touch on the holistic picture that you have mentioned, Madam Chair, but I think that's an important perspective. I'm representing the Law Society tennis profession on the board, and at the Law Society I'm also involved in legal education and specifically then the admission exam. And I must mention that and we have done some survey from time to time, part of the governance, and that from the profession side we are satisfied that the quality of people coming through the system in the legal aid court doesn't stand back in any way for people trained in the profession. So I think from the profession side we can give the assurance that the training that the legal aid court members receive does not stand back for the private profession.
I certainly wouldn't question that issue. We've come to the justice cases a while ago, and we see the kind of caseload that these young people are carrying. And it seems to me that they couldn't be a better trained person. But you would understand that what we're looking at is something much wider than just skilling and so on. It's ultimately something that is a concept of I'm going to give Mr. Yubad, and then you can answer Nash.
I don't
know if
you didn't
with
one issue that was in the next one.
No, I'm not
taking,
Mr.
Gilbert
wanted to talk about quality as well.
It's not a question, it's a suggestion. As far as the outcome analysis is concerned, I think we should add cases where we see the guilty and also maybe plea bargaining as a separate category.
Yes, that would be very useful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My input relates to a question emanating from Ms. Johnson there about the quality of, say, of the degree, how prepared a law graduate to enter the legal profession. One of my other hats that I wear is as a judge moderator in the National Bar Service. You've read about the outcry there about the high failure rate, particularly of black candidates. But the discussion has been held there to look at the preparedness of law graduates in the university, whether there is an opportunity for one to look at the content of that qualification. So I think that's in relation to the question I think you also raised, whether there's a role that the committee can play. I think I've had this discussion with the legal aid court people that I think there's more that the university can do in terms of helping the process, because first time candidates who ride the bike, then they will fail. Only very few, I think it's exceptional cases, pass. And the strange part of it is people who've done the law, the lawyers exam and themselves, they will serve until and then work for a year or two, then go and do pupillate and write that exam, they pass it sometimes. Which shows you that the exposure is there. Yeah, the practical part of the problem has been addressed. I don't know how they can do it. Perhaps the retention of what's there, or they'll tell you. Those are spoken about, maybe Professor Roda can help a little. But those I've spoken about tell them that we are here to teach. So I think there's something.
Except there's also the, and maybe I should put it to you because I don't have so much expertise in terms of education practice. But if the problem is practical exposure, practical experience in actually applying the law, then a return to the old undergrad LLB degree is not going to be too much. In terms of actually allowing universities to expose candidates for a period of whole issue of the undergraduate degree was also to address the fact that people did not have access to that profession. To spend money on an undergraduate degree that has sometimes absolutely nothing to do with law, then having to go and to get another degree was extremely expensive. Particularly for students who couldn't afford it, that's to make that the profession was close to work. And the idea very much was to say, okay, let's then introduce it as an undergraduate degree. And I think that there were no studies done to actually introduce that transformative piece of legislation that we have. Now I see that there is an enormous concentration coming from the universities themselves. Now whether that is because universities are not making as much money as they do, or whether in fact there is some sense in us reverting to the old system remains to be seen. I haven't studied the importance of it. But I do understand that seems to be the major reaction. But from what you're saying, I think that we need to rethink the concept of what currently is from the social system students are doing to practical application of the law. Perhaps you should just comment on that and I'll allow you.
Thank you, Chair. I think that's just had one dimension of what we've observed in terms of how people fail these exams. You have universities that have very well-run lodges where they have students take part in those. And those who if they go and do pupillage. So although sometimes pupillage is an individual thing, you may have a very good master who exposes you and takes an interest in what you do. Those that pass general are those who've gone through those universities that have well-functional logic. And I mean, a sad thing is you get guys from Qatar. You know, I mentioned this because I did the oral in the past year. You get guys from Qatar who are peace countries. They still have no clue what's happening. And then it saddens you to tell him that he's fake. And you can understand this is his second year. And a lot of money is going into him to get in there, but you still can get that profession. But you can understand that in those areas, nothing is happening in terms of transition. So it's just a dimension.
And also, isn't that also one of the, I know with candidates, as you did, you claim it. You're their principal. Likewise, with the attorney's profession, there's some reliance placed on the attorneys themselves to impart certain knowledge. I remember when I did my articles, I had an absolute defense. Luckily, I had Jody Collison who was downstairs from me. granted. But I mean, I do think that there's a certain degree of responsibility that principals should also bring to bear on these things. And perhaps the professions themselves should be looking at standardizing the mental of these individuals, because I see some of these candidates really, doing the most horrific things, like running around being messengers. And the most awful thing, and very degrading. It's not like they earn enormous salaries or sometimes no salaries at all. But I do think I think it's a combined effort that is required, and I don't think too much of emphasis should also be placed on exposure to university law training. Perhaps what we should be doing is to look at something called practical legal change. Perhaps we should be like the health profession, and that's why we have discussed I think the law space, I did something a long time ago, I think I don't know. First got to follow the issue. Long time. We discussed the possibility of community service within the degree as opposed to outside of the degree one says students. And I think we must revisit some of those discussions and start looking at the But I'd love to hear about it.
Yes, I think we I think the issue of the quality of legal education has been a sort of preoccupying law faculties for a long time. And at the very moment, I think the law deans and the LSA, the legal profession, are in regular meetings about how to address some of the concerns. A lot of the concerns have been coming from the profession. For a long time, the discussion was about vocational training. Should the university be doing it or should the profession be doing it? And the old system was that you had some academic knowledge and you came out and then you learned all the practical stuff when you were in the legal practice, serving articles. But I think that debate is a bit old now, actually, so far. And the way in which the universities have tried to deal with this issue is by integrating and increasing our skills courses in the curriculum. So, for example, there are courses in professional training, there's clinical law courses, which a certain number talked about. There are courses in training for people in basic legal research analysis and that kind of thing, which all contribute towards being a good practitioner at some level. But I think ultimately, clinics can only be a limited laboratory in some sense, and then the bigger sort of laboratory is really being out there in the practice in the real world, and getting those knobs and taking up from there. So I think that's really where it's going. And of course, it is in the context of having a compressed law degree, and I'm aware that some faculties are not necessarily happy with this, but I think by and large, most law faculties have embraced the 4 year of LLB for all the reasons that have been sort of advanced in the past, and we feel that we have to deliver on that basis. So I think the solution is to have an approach which increases the training component in the degree, but also not exclusively as the function of the law faculty to be shared with the profession in some sort of way. And I think there needs to be articulation between what is done at university and what's done in the profession in terms of the CA training. Can I just make one point about what Brian and Yang said earlier on in relation to the quality of CAs in the dealing board? I think Yang was going there, but some years ago, I don't have any recent information, but in KZN we did assessment and we found that candidate attendance came out of legal aid board on average fared much better than those coming out of the profession now. Those are statistics that I'm sure we can get readily if we just try to make that separation as well. That's another measure, not the only one, but certainly one measure of actually looking at the quality of training.
No, we certainly, obviously, the elements that we're discussing now can be elaborated upon but I think it's absolutely right, because you do get on a continuous basis to the perception based on the science and the people in their fields and so on, or whether it's the perception. There was a newspaper article that I've taken a part where issues were raised in court by attorneys who were advocates. Were suggesting that they'd written to the legal aid board about their fees, received no response, written again, received no response, and the judge then said, write again, received no response, that time. So, and I think that plays into image issues, it plays into perception issues, and it makes what we're hearing here completely alien to the kind of image that people have on the legal aid board. And I think a lot of that has to do with, and the debate eventually is going to be around quality. And I think if you start having an eye on it, not just at your individual level, but at the barometer level, the overall umbrella level in terms of the kind of questions that we're having now, you'll be able to answer those debates in a way that's meaningful, that is scientific, and that most people can understand. So really, what I'm saying is I think that needs to be done quite quickly. Anybody else on any of these matters? Let me just check. Sorry, Mr. Sivanyani, yes? Sure.
On two aspects, ESSA and PIE. For ESSA and PIE, even when you mention the PIE X specifically talk about legal aid, particular type of legal aid. My question is, the Land Assets Department, I think there was also a program of legally assisting people in the certificate on farm. Now, how do you, as a legal aid board, relate to the program or the project of the legal aid, of the Land Assets Department? Are there some identification or awareness?
Thanks. In fact, we at the moment in a partnership with the Rural Legal Trust, who has been funded by the Department of Land Research to actually provide assistance. So we are accommodating our justice center. And separate that we actually have assistance plans directly whenever they actually require assistance. The CEO mentioned about our other agreement for the land claims commission.
Let me just then finally talk about cash flow. Management project is now being adopted by the issue, particularly at the lowest of the end, and but the interesting thing that we've learned from the MPJ is, again, it's more recent than the sense that it's taken from the time that it was fully adopted. Is that in fact the case finalization plans have come longer to establish the case that about the finalization
kind of indication
more recent to the
reporting here in Thanks, Jefferson. Thanks. We're starting to get information from the state finalization plan still around 10. But what I don't have is comparatives from 5 years. So in terms of ourselves, we focus a lot on cases that have expired over 6 months, for instance, the Bitsy cost. The sense we are getting is that because we are now vigilantly monitoring case turnaround time, practitioners now take proactive measures to ensure that the cases are finalized. So in fact, our finalization, our pending rate year on year actually drops for the first time in the history of the Lake Board, and it's primarily because we are monitoring turnaround time. So I can't actually confirm what the MPA is saying. Our experience from the ground is, and how we are visually seeing, is that the case flow management have led to us playing a more proactive role in advancing difficulties we are experiencing with other stakeholders in ensuring that our cases proceed. So from a legally board perspective, we will advocate strongly that it is beneficial to us.
Yeah, no, I mean, subcommittee has been very, very concerned that we don't have the self reform because management. And so we've been very keen on the difficulty in the fact that the MPA can't come to a huge problem with that the cycle time is actually getting longer because there are certain factors that they point to, although they haven't been able to analyze fully. One of the things that we hear is that there are, for example, in the original report, only two cases to date they found out to be I guess in your case that wouldn't be such a problem because even if those cases fall flat, you've got the same legal representative being with another case with present at court and so on, and that's a real problem with you have outside the term. So if you would just keep a keen eye on it and let us know if you do have an indication that there's problems, even if it's very locally based, that would be very useful in our interventions
Judge,
I don't know if you want to add anything on
PESCO. Yeah, thank you, Chair. On PESCO, what I want to say is I've availed myself. I've addressed the heads of court meeting chaired by the Chief Justice. And when I have time, if I can take time from the FDA, where I do attend other meetings with the regional court president. My experience is you have some judicial heads that are taking a late decision. Some from, like this province, the Western Cape, the JP here is very active on that front. And when there's a problem, I know I'll get something from him. I've only received one letter from him in the past 2 years. But I know that he's an active role. Like the JP it varies regionally, but what I'm saying is, I've availed myself. All the judges around the country know that I'm there should there be any snags affecting their roles and their cases and whatever. But also to reiterate that our commitment is a legal report in ensuring that the wisdom comes.
I would very much appreciate
Your
taking the time to speak to me about this given the nature of the case we face, I imagine that so I would very much appreciate if there are difficulties at that level, we raise it as a matter of fact, of course, we are in peace. And then a judge raises it as a challenge. So please, won't you bring your influence to bear in that regard, and we would be appreciative. And if we can assist in any way, please let us know. One thing you've done with Texas too is for the project is to simply shut because of working at the national level. And we think that it's showing increase in finalization of the university. So I'm hoping that it's a speeding property and let us all do what we can in this regard. Finally, let me make just make some closing remarks. Firstly, in terms of the district, would be unqualified audit reports. So it's always answer the discussion. I think this committee, as you can see, we're not too raging mad today because we appreciate the fact that that we did receive an unqualified audit report. You should see us when you don't have that. But look, it is a matter to be proud of, and I think I would be if I did not I think that we've now received an unqualified for a few years now. The fact that you don't even have an emphasis on matter is for me, I'm not sure if this the auditor general having a bad day or whether you're having a good day. But either way, it's something to show off about, and we certainly want you to know that in terms of the organizational stuff, I think that there are some challenges. I think that particularly around your salary disparities, around going forward in terms of career planning, I think that must be looked at. On the substantive issues, and let me just again, without wanting to become too dramatic, I think that one of the things that this committee has always done, although we and Jake, we have some fairly fundamental disagreements. The one thing that we must never ever forget is that you have individuals who go to work every single day, who do their best under very trying circumstances, under enormously challenging circumstances. And what they do out of sheer commitment. Not because they earn enormous salaries, and not because they're going to have somebody throwing accolades at them. They do it because they're very dedicated South Africans who do their job, who take their job very seriously, and are very committed to this country and this constitution. And to each of them, we would like to say that we appreciate what they're doing, we recognize what they're doing, and that we understand that sometimes things are very challenging, and we hope that we will continue doing our part in terms of trying to reduce stresses and challenges. Hopefully together we can build an organization where everyone will find it to be not the best practice in the world, certainly the best practice on this one. The legal aid has always been a success story for the justice family. It's always been a success story in the form that it is now. You recall where we come from, and it's not a presentation. And so for us, whatever we do, whatever we say, ultimately, we look at it with a flavor of achievement. And I think that that achievement would not have been possible had we not, as South African Crown and States, come together as a justice family, notwithstanding the fact that the institution is independent, there has to be a degree of cooperation, a degree
collaboration, as you know, with other partners in your court at a more substantive level and certainly at the policy and strategy level. I want to suggest, as I said earlier, that in terms of these reports that we've now asked, you add a further report giving us, you've raised very starkly the issue of court decisions against the individual court in terms of providing legal services where perhaps people would not qualify or narrowly and so on. I would like an analysis of that. We don't in the committee have the capacity to do the legwork and the research. But clearly, if legislation is on the top, this information is going to be very important and crucial to set the design borders. We really need to address some of the things that have been happening over the past year. So I think that must be brought forward. I think certainly with regards to the guide, I will raise it at the level of the minister, but I also think that you need to let us have a copy of that. The issue of the civil work, I think we need to start discussing this as soon as possible. My feeling on the matter is that even if we're not going to go out and do a huge conference type of engagement, an opportunity should be found between ourselves and yourself to engage, even as a small, little occasion. We don't even have to give up lunch. We can give up some cold water. We'll take you up on the interstate. Knowing, of course, that you don't have a lot of time. On that note, let me thank all of you. Thank you all for an elaborate report. Oh, one more thing. One of the things that we've asked the department to do, as well as the other institutions that we oversee, with your NPH table, to give us a breakdown of that in a comprehensive way, in one place. It's a bit difficult to read your annual report if you do the breakdowns of your financial statements. And I don't see that table that usually appears in the FPS period. And to then give us the actual expenditure versus the amount budget is for the that's for the next, I see that you people have already started your annual report. But I think it's important that we have that financial breakdown in one place. Because what that does is not only puts us at a glance to look at what it is that you've been given, if you've been given anything extra over the year, have you received any donations, but everything then, and then what your expenses are, whether there was an over expense or under expense, all of those things at a glance, so that there's a financial summary that happens. And then you can give us a breakdown. One of the problems that we have in this committee, over the next 2 weeks, we're going to, well, over the last 4 weeks, we've been looking at about 23 different things. And it becomes incredibly taxing to look at annual reports of each of those things. And we do it, on consecutive days. And so it would be very nice if we could have in future an analysis of your financial statements, analysis of your big human resources challenges, an analysis of things like your priorities, quality assurance, those kinds of things, as you were going to make in your presentation, in a separate document over and above the annual report, which is not to say that we don't read them, but that we can't read them with as much intensity now as we will, for example, in preparation for the budget today, that we will be having around the 29th and the 12th. Come and have a cocktail with us. Not to say that we have a bigger budget than you, but this cocktail comes from the department fund, which is funds that they should be giving to you, apparently. So, at least what you can do is you can come and have some of their food. So that would be very nice if you could at least be represented during that occasion. And you'll see there that members prepare quite intensively. Going back to the annual report, going back to the presentations that you've made and so on. And I know that half of the time we get the feeling that, well, this is a whole year's work. We don't adjust the system in day or half day. The truth of the matter is that, unfortunately, the system that we have, we'd be very happy to sit on the board. If we go was the invitation. So, barring that, and I'll still try and lobby for that eventuality in my lifetime. Because I do think that oversight has got a different meaning to the kind of so maybe in a few years' time, you'll see when you bring that axe to us, we'll carve a role out for some invisible spirit so that you can come and put on your board. And in that way, perhaps be a little more intensively engaged on an ongoing basis. Because I do understand that your challenges in terms of investing. But in the meantime, let me thank you very much for the report, for the time and submission of them. Mm. And I will thank you in advance for giving me those other reports. Please try and do it before the 19th. Did I say I was there for the 19th? Yes, did I say the
19th?
We'd like it before the 19th because that's when we finalize these hearings and that we are then able to look back at those reports. Members, thank you very much. You would note in terms of your program that we have given the opportunity for the Legal Aid Board to come tomorrow in anticipation of their being caucus in the morning. We have set them down to continue should we not have finished today, tomorrow afternoon. However, we have finished today, happily. And happily, I don't know about the DA, but seeing as you have a new leader, you're going to have a caucus. You have a caucus. We happily do not have a caucus. This issue for a reason that will remain unknown at this stage. but that caucus will happen sometime.
Mm. No longer.
Pardon?
As you say, where we come from, Noma Ganja.
On that note, let me thank everybody, members. Thank you very much again for your hard work. And we will meet each other on Friday with the Chief Justice, who will be addressing us on Friday. Please, we start at 10 o'clock. Please let us find you on time at this venue. We then also are hosting the Chief Justice for lunch, so please don't miss one off on a Friday. I know people are needing to go home and constituencies and stuff like that, but please try and arrange that your flight a little later so that you can accommodate the lunch period. It doesn't look good when the Chief Justice is here and I'm the only one sitting all the time having lunch. It doesn't look good for the separation of powers. And that's not good for me because I run out of conversation. not true. Chief Justice is very interesting. I had supper with him the other day. He talks about all kinds.
Is the deputy coming?
With him and have lunch by myself. Don't write anything.
No, he's asking you a question.
Oh, no. I'm pointing to the lady from PNC. Just end the meeting a long time. Thank you very much, members. There's lunch for us outside. Please join us for lunch.
Born every now and then,
Yes, thank you. Thank you.